Well, what's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? This is another fantastic episode of Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. We got some great interviews coming up in the show, talking about DEI, AI, wealth taxes in California, stuff like that. Some great interview guests. We'll be doing Dumb Bleep of the Week in Hour 3, as usual, with 10 great options to choose from that the Fed Haters Club is going to be voting on, including a few clips from Biden's State of the Union address. We'll also be talking about Biden's new $7.3 trillion budget proposal for 2025, because we have plenty of money, no problem. And you might not believe it, but the U.S. just prosecuted their first person for smuggling greenhouse gases from Mexico. Yeah. What? That's a real thing. But first, I got to tell you, Free Talk Live is brought to you by Dash. Digital cash with fees of less than a penny per transaction. Dash is made for spending. Dash is one of the oldest cryptocurrencies and is widely available on exchanges, including the decentralized Maya protocol and in multi-crypto wallets. Thanks to the Dash DAO for sending us 32 Dash per month for this sponsorship. It's easy to get and use Dash. You can learn more at Dash.org. That's Dash.org. And this is, of course, Liberty at Night on Free Talk Live. But don't forget that Charlie and I have a daily show called Good Morning Liberty. You can find that on your favorite podcast app, by the way, or by going to BernieLies.com. We give you the daily news from a libertarian mindset. That's Good Morning Liberty. Live liberty in the pursuit of meaning every single day of the week. Smash subscribe, smash follow, smash all of the things, and you'll get us a brand new episode. This is episode 1193, I think. Holy crap. That's too many episodes.
It's about time, about time to retire.
I mean, next week we're going to be hitting episode 1200. 1,200 episodes.
That's pretty crazy.
How have we not saved the world already by now?
You would think.
If everyone would just listen, take the 1,200 episode challenge, then I think things would be so much better.
That's right.
We had a fully prepared episode, like a great, huge episode prepared for today. And then at 11 p.m. Central Time, the White House released
AM.
AM Central Time. See, my time's all mixed up, you know. The White House and President Joseph R. Biden released their fiscal year 2025 budget proposal. And boy, is it a doozy. It's a lot. They got all these fact sheets out there, which means they're all lies the whole time. They've got several different pages.
Lie sheets.
Of fact sheets out here. And it's really bad. It's $7.3 trillion proposed budget. $7.3 trillion.
But first, before we dive into that, I got to tell you about the 2A summit coming up next weekend.
Ah, there you go.
I'll be speaking.
It's not next week. It's the weekend after. Oh, wait, that's this weekend. It is next weekend.
It is next weekend.
You see, my times are all messed up.
The 23rd. How about you just let me do it?
I've lost all muscle control.
Why don't you just let me shut your mouth?
Okay.
Shut your mouth. Shut it.
It's next weekend.
Shut your mouth. I got this. All right. Next weekend, March 23rd, I'll be speaking at the 2A Summit. Just me, by the way, because obviously Nate can't talk. You guys have heard it.
No, my time's all messed up.
No, Nate has an obligation to go to a good one, I think.
Yeah. Don't say it, though.
I'm not. I'm just saying it'll be fun. Mm-hmm. I'll be speaking at the 2A Summit in Knoxville, Tennessee. Be there or don't.
Yeah, you should. Those are your two options, I think you should choose one of them. Yeah.
But you can get more information by going to the2asummit.com. That's the number two, the numerical dos.
The letter two.
Yeah. Letter two.
What's that from? No, there's something. Dang anyway. It.
Is anyway, that when Big Bird gets high or something?
So, yeah, something like, I can't remember what it was.
There's a YouTube about it or something.
That's an old one. That's a really old one.
I forgot about that. Yeah. Anyway, the letter two. the2asummit.com. Go find out more information. Get registered. Come see the better half of Good Morning Liberty. What can I say?
So in 2019, our budget, I believe the closest figures I could find, now this is from the Federal Reserve, and sometimes those numbers differ a little bit from some of the White House numbers and all that, but according to them, our federal outlays, our expenses, in 2019 were like $4.8 trillion. Like that's what we spent. I realize we're not there yet, but due to essentially the pandemic and everyone being okay with all the new money being spent, we're approaching doubling our budget from, by this time, the budget from 5 years before that. That's wild to me, doubling the federal budget. Mm-hmm. Now, we haven't fully doubled it, so it's going to take a couple more years to get there. But holy crap, is there nothing so permanent as a temporary government program? That is, truer words have hardly ever been never spoken. Okay. And so that we get all these things from the pandemic, like,
then we spent about $6.5 trillion though in 2020.
Yeah.
2020.
Then we spent like more than that afterwards. I mean, it's a lot. It's a mm-hmm. lot of money. So, and now all of a sudden, guess what?
We
can't live without spending that much money. We just can't do it.
You know, the leftists like to talk about how big a billion is when it comes to these rich billionaires, mm-hmm. like how big a billion is. Do you guys know how big a trillion is? Like, just one of the trillions?
It's bigger.
It's, yeah.
Bigger. How many is it?
Well, it's 1,000 billions.
1,000.
Yeah.
Billions.
Yeah.
That's just a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of billions.
That's a lot. How many times can you go back and forth?
I don't remember those stats anymore. You used to remember all that random crap.
I think it's 33 times.
I don't remember.
If I remember correctly.
It's something like that.
Yeah. That's in miles.
With a trillion.
Yeah. Trillion miles, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
It's been years since I looked at those kind of numbers. We should do that sometime though with this one.
Yeah, you should.
So $7,300 billion budget proposal for 2025. And as I was about to say before we started the show, remember Biden in his State of the Union speech was saying, just imagine what we could do with $50 billion by instituting a billionaire minimum 25% tax. Just imagine, he names off all these things. And he's talking about $50 billion. They're proposing a $7,300 billion budget for 2025.
For 1 year.
For one, that's one single year.
And keep in mind also how he touted how he brought the deficit down.
He did. Yeah. Well, this one apparently is going to bring the deficit down even more, I guess, which is amazing because the numbers they use for how much Trump added to the deficit, they're going to bring that. The finagling with the numbers are always, of course, if they do all these things without all the tax cuts, and what if we do all the tax cuts, and what, and then they just give you these basically budget on top of fake number on top of fake number, and here's how much we're going to save you guys inside of this proposal to spend way more money. And things like this only work if you, they only work in your mind if you believe that the government can just spend money and that it's going to be helpful for people and that it's not going to affect anything. Like, if you think that the government can spend money without it having any effect on your life, I don't mean without you getting the money that they're spending, but that they can tax all of this money from billionaires and corporations and millionaires, and then that's not going to affect you, you're wrong. I'm sorry. I understand why you might think that. But the government is going to take this out of the productive side of the economy. $7.3 trillion if they are going to spend that. Now, they're not going to take all that because there's going to be a deficit, of course. But as Milton Friedman said, and has said a lot of times, the true tax on the American people is what the government spends. Mm-hmm. It's not even what...
It doesn't matter whether they print it or take it directly from you.
Doesn't matter if they're going to spend $7.3 trillion and they only tax out of the economy $5 trillion. Now, yeah, we got a $2.3 trillion deficit at that point, which I think the projection is a $1.8 trillion deficit, actually, for 2025, if they go with
this. But
you
could at least double that.
But what the true tax is what they spend, because when, you know what, I'll just have him tell you. We'll just have him tell you. It's only 43 seconds. Here you go.
The true tax that the American people pay is what government spends. If the federal government spends $61 billion more than it takes in, who do you suppose pays the difference? You pay it. I pay it. We pay it as taxpayers. The only thing is, instead of calling that a tax, we pay it in the form of a hidden tax called inflation, or in an even more deeply hidden tax called government borrowing. But both of those are forms of taxation. So nobody has proposed to reduce taxes. What they have proposed is to shift the form of taxation, to rely somewhat less on such direct taxes as income taxes, and somewhat more on such indirect taxes as inflation and borrowing.
There you go. All right. That's pretty good, Milton. I agree.
Yeah.
I think he's right about that. So it doesn't matter.
Could
how
you imagine
much,
only having a $61 billion deficit?
He said $61 billion because that was like a really big number.
Yeah,
in 1975 or whenever it was that they were doing this video.
Well, you know, seven's a lot smaller number than 61.
That's true. Much smaller. Before we go any further, I'm going to tell you guys about our newest sponsor, Noble Gold Investments. The government punishes you for keeping your wealth or your money, your cash in a savings account. And how do they do that? Because of inflation. Inflation is a tax on savers. It's a systemic erosion of your wealth. Items that cost $10 today will cost $15 tomorrow, but your savings account will still have the same amount of money, and it's losing its purchasing power. Trust me, I've done it before. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. This is exciting because gold can be a hedge against inflation. It remains steady when inflation's on the rise. The dollar's in turmoil. It can be a defense against economic downturn. All that good stuff. Money, you know, unlike money, gold can't be printed. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. To find out more, go to noblegoldinvestments.com/GML. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/GML. Let's get back to the show. Okay, so let's go into the actual, there's an article on this from the Washington Examiner. White House unveils $7.3 trillion tax and spend budget for 2025. Clearly, Washington Examiner is a far-right fascist publication or whatever people would say, I don't know. The White House on Monday released a proposed budget for 2025 that contains a wish list of tax increases and spending proposals, favored by Democrats, of course. The budget includes $7.3 trillion in spending and a $5.5 trillion in tax revenue, bringing the deficit for 2025 to nearly $1.8 trillion. This is a guy who was just boasting about, you know, cutting the deficit, of course. The budget would significantly raise taxes from roughly 18% of GDP to over 20% of GDP. It would not close the deficit in the 10-year budget window and would see the federal debt held by the public rise as high as 106% of GDP.
By the way, the tax will never go over 20% of GDP. It's going to stay between the 17 to 19% range. It always has and always will.
That's basically what it's now. We are in the highs right now. We're roughly around actually 19% of GDP right now. The historical average is around 17. That's pretty much what it stays around. So we are at all-time highs. We've already talked about this in the past. We're already at all-time high amounts of taxation when it comes to the percentage of GDP and when it comes to the amount of money that the government is taking in taxes. Like all those things are at all-time highs. Why does it matter what the percentage of GDP is? Well, because that's the productive capacity of our economy. That's what we produce, you know, and then they're going to take a percentage of it through various different forms of taxation, of course, not all one specific kind of taxation, but they're going to take that and then they're going to spend more than whatever amount it is that they just took. And then they're going to have to try and pay for that later on, either with inflation or with paying back whatever debt that they borrowed from people. And so that number does matter, of course, because the true tax is what the government spends. It's got to get paid for somehow. And people think that if you have the billionaires pay for it or whatever, if you have corporations pay this minimum tax of 21%, I think is the number that he's talking about now.
It looks like they want to raise it.
Yeah, they want
21 to 28.
So that's how they fix that. We had an issue when we listened to the State of the Union. We said, well, if they're going to do a minimum tax of 21%, well, that would mean they're not going to allow for any deductions because the current tax rate is 21%. Meaning everyone's just going to pay that with no deductions. What they want to do is raise it to 28 and then allow, yes, for some deductions, but everyone has to pay a minimum rate of 21%, no matter what it is that you spend. And the thing is, corporations don't pay taxes. Corporations' customers pay taxes because taxes are just an expense that a business pays. And people like to think that you can just tax the corporations and they're going to pay it. But where do corporations get their money? You're going to tax the billionaires and make them pay? Well, where do billionaires get their money? Like, this is all through providing products and services to people in the economy. That's where they get their money. And so if the government's just going to come in and take a portion of that, we think they're just going to take it, lying down, say, okay, well, I guess I'll make a whole lot less money than I was making. You know, that's fine. Daddy government says I'm going to make... No, they're going to raise their prices up so they can keep making the same percentages they've been making. It's pretty easy, y'all. So anyway, Biden wants to raise the corporate minimum tax from 15 to 21 and introduce more stringent limits on corporations' ability to deduct wages of high-paid employees. According to the White House, I believe he said they want to cap that at $1 million in total compensation. So right now, like, you can write off what a CEO's total compensation is. I don't know what the cap is. I think maybe it's 20 million or something right now, whatever it is. He wants to cap that at $1 million. So even if your CEO, say your CEO of Walmart got 22 million in total compensation, you can only deduct $1 million of that off of it, which is just great. Why don't we just try to depress the wages of CEOs? That way people have a harder time going out and getting the best people to run their companies. That's going to have no effect on people in the economy at all.
Well, it'll finally make everything fair, Nate.
Oh, yeah, fairness. Mm-hmm. That's right. Biden's made it his goal to increase taxes not only on corporations, but also on the wealthiest. The president has vowed not to raise taxes on those making less than $400,000 per year, although he has come out fervently in favor of soaking the very wealthy. Congress, though, has blocked most of those efforts. That's something important to remember. This is a budget proposal. For these things to happen, Congress will have to pass laws to do all of these things. So while it's fun for us to talk through this, and it does give you a little bit of, it shines a little bit of light on just how crazy the people working at the White House are and the people doing the budgets are, and Biden, not that he has anything to do with this because he's a houseplant at this time, barely alive. In the latest budget request, the White House also calls for a 25% minimum tax for billionaires. That provision would only affect the wealthiest 0.01% of taxpayers, according to the White House. We talked about this on Friday also after the State of the Union. For a 25% minimum tax for billionaires, you're going to have to do an unrealized wealth tax, unrealized capital gains tax to be able to get to 25%. And that's probably not something that's going to happen, but do keep in mind they're releasing this in an election year to try and show people all the great things that they will get if you reelect Biden for another 4 more years. Yep. Honestly, at this point, I think Trump should stop campaigning against Biden and campaign against Kamala Harris. I think that would be a bigger play for him.
And you think so?
Because, I mean, listen, dude. I mean, look, seriously. How long is Biden actually going to live?
As long as you're clear about this.
Let's be clear. We should. You think Biden's going to serve a second term?
No.
I think the only reason he's here right now is to try and get them through the election, because no one would go and vote for Kamala Harris. But
once he gets the nominee, he's going to drop out?
I would like to keep that conspiracy theory out there. Yes. Mm-hmm. I would like to keep it out there that at the convention they end up switching over to someone else. Maybe it depends on what the polls show at that time. Where are we? Raising the corporate tax rate to 28% would raise some $1.35 trillion over the next decade or so, which is $135 billion.
It's $135 billion.
A year. And they're talking about spending $7,300 billion next year. According to the administration's latest budget projections, which were released Monday, while the billionaire minimum tax plan would bring in about $500 billion, over that same period.
Which is 10 years.
They do everything based on 10 years. What's also
great, now we're up to $185 billion.
Yeah.
In added taxes, by the way, if they're able to collect all that.
Mm-hmm.
If they're somehow, the government has projected things finally.
Yes.
Perfectly.
For the first time ever.
Which, by the way, companies, people get projections wrong all the time. Government seems to grossly underestimate. I mean, gross. Like, my God, if you were the CEO of a company or CFO and you had these grossly underestimated budgets all the time, overestimated projections.
Overestimated incomes and underestimated expenses.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You would be fired. You wouldn't be able to find a job.
Well, yeah, you're running the company.
But let's say
$2 trillion in the hole every year.
Let's say that the government actually gets this one right. And by raising these taxes, and the wealthy people aren't going to find a way out of it, the corporations aren't going to find a way out of it. You know, what that so far we've seen now an extra $185 billion per year.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty good stuff.
Yeah.
I'm, hold on. Let me
that gets us to, you. I don't even, not even 10% yet of the extra spending.
That's I think that's $20 billion a day that they'd be spending if they actually enacted this budget. 17 has been the number we've been using because that's what they've been doing for a bit. So we're moving it up to $20 billion a day. Mm-hmm. So from what you just said, they're talking about $185 billion. So that's nine days.
That's only, by the way, that's only getting to like 10% of the projected deficit of 1.8 trillion.
Yeah.
By the way. So
I'm sure they have a plan. Also in the proposed budget are housing provisions. Housing affordability is at record lows as mortgage rates remain prohibitive and housing supply languishes. To address this, the administration has proposed a few changes, although critics say it would do little to help housing supply and paradoxically could even make the situation worse by dialing up demand.
Weird.
Yeah. That's what would happen. If
could even make the situation worse. Like,
yeah. Housing prices are too high and we don't have enough supply of houses. You know what we're going to do? We're going to give everyone a housing gift card. Here you go. Here's $10,000. That should fix the problem. Among the proposals is providing a $5,000 tax credit for middle-class first-time homebuyers for 2 years, described as a form of mortgage relief. The president is also asking Congress to approve a $10,000 credit for those who sell their starter homes. The administration...
Would this be a starter home? My first one?
I don't know. I don't know whether qualifies as a starter home.
Yeah.
Mine's a starter home, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I don't know if yours is or not.
It's the first home I've built.
This is the house you started with.
Yep.
You know?
This is my starter house.
Technically a starter home. Yeah. Let's see.
Other than that, I was just getting, you know, ravaged by landlords.
Yeah. Biden's budget.
Renting from them, you know?
The budget also calls for a national comprehensive, you see, you want things to be comprehensive, paid family and medical leave program providing up to 12 weeks of leave for eligible workers. That's something the government should be paying for. That would cost some $325 billion over the next decade or so. And of course, we got a whole lot more to talk about on this, but we are coming up on a quick break. And we'll be talking about the rest of this crazy $7.3 trillion budget. First guy in the U.S. to be prosecuted for smuggling greenhouse gases. Dumb bleep of the week. A couple interviews. A whole lot more to come on Liberty Unite on the Free Talk Live Network.
On Free Talk Live, we're bringing people to the ideas of liberty every day. From wrestling superstars like Glenn Jacobs.
You guys really are having an impact, I believe. Like I said, a lot of where I am now is due to listening to Free Talk Live. You changed my mind on some very important issues years ago.
To random people tuning in on the radio.
I was kind of stuck in the left-right paradigm. I heard your show by chance on a Saturday night. From there, I went on, joined the Free State Project and become an amplifier. So, I mean, that's really the reason why I amp is because I know that if it wasn't for you guys being on as many stations as you are, I never would have found the ideas of liberty.
You can help more people hear the message of liberty by joining Free Talk Live's AMPS program on Patreon for as little as $5 a month. And you'll get access to special perks. Visit amps.freetalklive.com, amps.freetalklive.com.
What's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? This is Liberty Unite with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network. We are back. We've been going through this $7.3 trillion 2025 budget proposal from the White House because apparently we have plenty of money. As I guess we just need to steal the right amount of money from the people in the U.S. No problem whatsoever with that. Before we get back into this, I'm going to remind everyone that Free Talk Live is brought to you by Dash Digital Cash. With fees of less than a penny per transaction, Dash is made for spending. It's one of the oldest cryptocurrencies and is widely available on exchanges, including the decentralized Maya protocol and in multi-crypto wallets. Thanks to the Dash DAO for sending us 32 Dash per month for this sponsorship. It's easy to get and use Dash, and you can learn more at dash.org. And of course, once again, before we get back into it, we're going through some of the items in this 2025 budget. If you want to hear us talk about stuff like this every single day, like you're just not getting enough in this Tuesday night show from Liberty at Night, then you can go find Charlie and I's podcast, Good Morning Liberty, on your favorite podcast app, or you can search BernieLies.com in your browser, and that's going to bring up links to everything. You can watch videos of the episodes and tons of other videos, and find us on all of the social media that there is out there. Good AM Liberty on X or Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and even TikTok until it gets banned, I guess. So make sure you go find Good Morning Liberty. Let's get back into it. I hate all of the 10-year projections. The reason I hate all of this...
That would probably cost $325 billion a year.
Yeah. The reason I hate all of these 10-year projections is because they like it. It's like assuming that no one's going to say we should do a new program in a couple of years.
But do you know why they do that, though?
Why?
Because everything's supposed to balance within 10 years.
I got you.
So that's what they always say, like, oh, well, we're on a 10-year balanced budget cycle. But then it never go back 10 years from now. You actually have to go back 30 years the last time we had a balanced budget.
Yeah.
More than 30 years at this point.
What I hate about it is that it assumes this idea that we're not going to find new things that Congress thinks we should spend money on in the next 10 years. So giving these 10-year projections and here's what it's going to look like, it's all completely irrelevant. When new administrations come in, new Congresses come in, new demands from the American people pop up, we all know there's going to be new programs.
Isn't that what like a discretionary fund is for? Like in your house?
I guess,
right? You have like an emergency fund or like a discretionary fund.
Yeah.
Or you have a fund sitting there that says, okay, if something pops up that we didn't expect in our budget, in our projections for our expenses this year and our living situation and condition, we have something we could tap into. But no, the problem is the government spends all of that.
Yeah, we have to borrow our discretionary fund also.
Yeah.
The proposal also includes expanding the child tax credit to the supercharged level it was temporarily at as part of the pandemic era America Rescue Plan Act, which passed with no Republican support. The current tax credit is $2,000 per child. The 2021 Democratic legislation raised it to $3,600 for children under six and $3,000 for older children, with perhaps the biggest change being the removal of an income threshold for those who receive the funds. Thus, a family with no income or head of household working would also receive the full $3,600 or $3,000 payments. That tax credit sunsetted at the end of 2021. Reinstating that child tax credit would cost an estimated $310 billion through 2034. I mean, if it helps one child, Charlie.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, our children are hungry.
Yeah. In October 2023, the administration transmitted an emergency supplemental request for managing the southwest border and migration totaling $13.6 billion. The White House said, oh, I skipped a paragraph up here. It includes funding to hire 1,300 additional Border Patrol agents, 1,000 additional Customs and Border Protection officers, and additional 1,600 asylum officers and support staff, and nearly $850 million for cutting-edge detection technology at ports of entry. Of course, if I were just a Republican, I would say that doesn't do anything to solve the problem of the fact that people are just coming across willy-nilly, and then you got to hire more people to deal with that. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, the people coming across are all looking for those ports of entry.
Yeah, they can't find them. They won't put lights around them, like flashing lights around those things. So there's several of these fact sheets out here. Like, we don't have time to read through all this stuff. Just so you know, it's wild propaganda that comes from stuff on the White House press release. It's ridiculous.
So my grandmother used to say it's a bunch of gobbledygook.
They talk about expanding access to quality, affordable health care. They say health care should be a right, not a privilege. So they're talking about expanding Obamacare, essentially, at this time. Medicaid programs,
stuff like
that.
The incredible success of the Affordable Care Act.
Very successful. Lowering drug prices.
You know, all of the nonprofit health insurance companies that the Affordable Care Act created.
Yeah, they're very successful.
They all went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them.
But at least they tried.
And then United is as rich as ever.
Lowers drug prices and expands access to prescription drugs.
Unless they quit making them.
Exactly. unless they rip it right out of the hands of the sick children, like up there in Massachusetts, you know, stuff like that. The Inflation Reduction Act rebates and $2,000 out-of-pocket prescription drug cost cap beyond Medicare and into the commercial market. Just so you know, these cost caps, all it means is that it caps the out-of-pocket cost for you. The company still gets paid. They just cap your out-of-pocket costs, and then the government pays the rest of it. So while they portray these things as handing it to Big Pharma, like, it just caps what you pay into it, and then you still pay into it because the government uses your money to still pay for the rest of it. They just expect that you're going to be an idiot about it or whatever. You think it's someone else's money that's getting used to pay that.
Yeah.
So these little cost capping things are really good for PR releases, but of course they're still paying for the drugs. They're still trying to negotiate drug prices and make them lower, but of course that's going to also lead to less drugs being available and less new drugs being available too. Lowers child care costs for hardworking families. What if you're like you just work like normal?
Yeah.
You know, not hard.
A medium working family.
Yeah. You know, like you work a couple days a week.
A soft working family. You know?
The president is committed to providing relief to hardworking families. His budget creates a historic new program under which working families with incomes up to $200,000 per year would be guaranteed affordable, high quality child care from birth until kindergarten, with most families paying no more than $10 a day and the lowest income families paying nothing. This would provide a lifeline to the parents of more than 16 million children. The budget also includes $8.5 billion for the Child Care and Development Block Grant, which allows states to expand child care assistance and serve over 2 million low-income children.
It's for the children.
It is for the children. Now, I take issue with the way that they word things. Like, most families will be paying no more than $10 a day. Low-income families will be paying nothing. We started off the show by saying that for these things to work, for you to read this and be like, oh, that sounds good, you have to believe that the government can just spend money, that they can tax money out of the economy from corporations or billionaires or people making over $400,000 a year. You have to believe that they can do all of that, they can borrow money, they can print money, and that it's not going to cost you anything. And for you to be able to read this and say these sound like good ideas, you have to say, well, I bet that 18% inflation since 2020 had nothing to do with the money the government was spending at all. I bet it has nothing to do with the printing that they were doing to cover their huge deficits every year. I bet that was just probably grocery stores raising their prices to price gouge people. And so if you believe things like that, then you can read a paragraph and actually believe what it says. But if you think for a minute, or you have just like a baseline basic economics knowledge, then you know that there's no such thing as a family paying no more than $10 a day or low-income families paying nothing at all.
Somebody's paying something.
Somebody's paying something. Even low-income families are purchasing products at a grocery store. You know, even low-income families probably got a car, or they got gas somewhere, or they do something where they pay for goods and services. And things like this, all they do is raise the price of all of our goods and services in the economy.
It's just shifting.
It is.
So yeah, you're not paying that daycare bill, but you probably paid it in food prices or energy prices or rent prices. It's just shifting where that money is going. You're still spending the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's just going a different place.
Let's see. Strong foundation for families. So they want to do universal pre-K and Head Start, because that's...
Which studies show it does nothing.
But some studies show it does. So you got to look at those studies,
yeah,
and go off of what they say. You know, there are certain studies that say there's no correlation between the two. And there are studies that say, well, obviously it had a good effect on people. And there are those that will say it's just correlation and causation. And those are not the same thing.
Well, I was told Parker got autism because I didn't read to him enough.
Oh, yeah.
So read to your kids.
So go there, you go. Read to them.
Yeah. Otherwise, it might get autism.
Yeah. Now, here's one thing that I hate that they do. They talk about cutting taxes for families with children and American workers. The way that they talk about cutting taxes is by doing these child tax credits. So my question is, why wouldn't they just cut taxes? If you're cutting taxes, then why aren't you cutting taxes? That's my question.
Instead of giving like a refund.
Instead of giving a credit from other people's taxes.
Yeah.
There's a big reason that they would not just want to cut taxes. It's because then they would show people where the money comes from. And instead, what they want to do is they want to charge you money and then give you money back from other people's pockets or from your own pocket also that they took out of your paycheck all year. And then it makes these child tax credits, they can go away, they can come back, they can go away. You know what would happen if they cut...
Well, and then these people get a bigger refund.
Yeah. You know what would happen
they get all excited about it.
If they cut people's taxes? They wouldn't be able to raise them afterwards because people will be like, hey, I've been paying 2%. You know, you guys charge me 2% because that's the tax bracket I'm in. You cut my taxes. What, and now you want to, because this child tax credit thing is gone, you want to raise my taxes back up to 18%? I don't want you raising my taxes back up. So instead of actually doing a tax cut for people, they just do it in the form of some type of a credit that they give you afterwards, because that's easier to take away. It's the same reason that instead of giving everyone a raise, say when the corporate tax cuts went through, people say, oh, they gave people bonuses, or you know, they did stuff like that, because if you give someone a raise, it's tough to ever decrease their pay back down afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same thing. If you give someone a tax cut, it's tough for you to ever raise it back up afterwards without losing your elections. So I don't like them calling it a tax cut when they're not cutting taxes. They're just doing tax credits for people. Let's see. What else have we
got? And also, if you pay no taxes, if you're getting a refundable tax credit for children, then you actually make money.
Net receiver.
Paying any taxes.
Yeah.
At all.
Which is... I can't remember what bracket it is. I think it's the bottom quintile. The effective tax rate is, what is it, negative 2.2%, something like that.
They get money back. Well, we don't count those, though.
Oh, yeah. That's not, according to Saws and Zuckman, you know, that's not true.
That skews the study.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we talked about the affordable housing supply thing. This is a completely ridiculous idea. The government, it all comes back to the same thing. Where is the government going to get the money to put back into these specific programs? Where's the money come from?
You.
It comes from you. And mm-hmm. You're like, oh, no, because I make less than $400,000 a year. Do you buy things from corporations? Then it comes from you. Do you buy any? Have you seen inflation? Did you see prices go up over the last few years? It comes from you. That's where it comes from.
Always.
Always comes from you. And they've successfully been able to get, I guess, a large enough group of people to think that it doesn't come from them. And that's why they go so hard on this idea that inflation was price gouging. You see, because it can always come back to inflation. Maybe you're not going to be affected by any of these taxes or whatever, you know,
directly. But
you're still going to be affected by inflation. And so when it comes to inflation, they have to convince you that that was just price gouging and that they didn't actually have to raise their prices. That gives them the last little bit of cover that they needed to be able to just spend whatever amount of money that they want to spend.
I don't know if it's genius or there are that many people that, you know, to think, especially with some of these people that have degrees even, that they would be smart enough just to ask one more question. You know, that they just, they leave off that question.
Mm-hmm.
They leave off the final why.
Yeah.
You know, if you just ask why one more time.
Well, it's the thing is everyone,
or who?
Everyone thinks it's safer to like go along with this because you think that you're going to be getting, you know, it's not that people are getting your money, you know, you think that you're going to be able to get all this stuff by getting that guy's money over there. And so it's going to be good for you. But the problem is he's getting yours. So it doesn't work out.
Yeah,
I just paraphrased a really good Milton Friedman quote right there. But that's what's happening. And okay, let's see what else we got. Affordable rent through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Now, when they emphasize that...
I thought the left was against vouchers.
Rent choice.
Oh, okay.
No, you know what we need to do? We just need public rent. We don't need to do... That's a good... Hold on a sec. I gotta remember this. Let me take a screenshot of that. Okay. Yeah. Just so we can remember that right there. Housing Choice Voucher Program. Why not just build public out? Why would you let people take their voucher to wherever they want to live?
Right.
Doesn't make any sense. That's bad for the people that build low-cost housing.
It is. You know? That's bad for the public housing that already exists.
It's going to put them out of business. Okay. That doesn't do anything to address the affordability problems. They do a lot of these housing, affordable rent. Then they talk about affordable college, stuff like that. But none of the things they talk about address why the things cost what they cost. Why are the prices so expensive on all these things? Instead, they say, we're going to make them affordable by giving you back some of your money that you paid in taxes to go towards this stuff. And then they say they've made it more affordable after that. But they have not talked about why those things are so expensive in the first place. Like college is a really good example. They talk a lot about how they're going to spend a bunch of money towards college and do more Pell Grants and things like that. But not a single word in any of this stuff addresses why college is so expensive. And college is so expensive because the government already puts way too much money in the college.
We should have college vouchers.
There you go. They basically do have college vouchers, essentially.
Yeah.
I guess it's okay once you get up to the colleges. So they got improved college affordability. Once again, they're not improving the cost of college. They're improving your cost of college by giving you more of your own money that you're going to pay back throughout your life. And so that doesn't actually solve the problem of why college is so expensive. In fact, it's going to make it more expensive. And it's going to make it harder for people to go without trying to get government money because they just increase the cost of it.
And these endowments of these massive universities will just keep getting bigger.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Why aren't the colleges demonized the way Amazon is demonized?
It's because the colleges are the ones teaching this stuff.
True. Why doesn't the college teach college students to demonize the college?
Yeah, of course they wouldn't.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Lowers
the people
costs.
Who's making stuff. It's their fault.
So anyhow, there's all kinds of stuff in this, in all these fact sheets. There were six or seven different fact sheets that we could go through, and I'm sure people are going to dig more stuff out of. The bottom line is, this is a ridiculous budget, $7.3 trillion. Good Lord.
Don't think it'll happen.
No, it's not going to be that much, but it's what they do is it's like a negotiating tactic. Like, we want all this stuff. And then people are going to fight for some of it. They'll get some of it. And they'll find a way to spend close to $7.3 trillion. It's just not going to be on the specific things that are in this list. It's going to be half-assed versions of some of these things. And it's still going to cost the same amount of money.
Yeah, you know, they'll spend so at least $6.5 trillion.
Before you go, I got to...
And we're not taking in 5.5.
We just got into the energy.
We're taking about $5 trillion.
We just got in the energy section. I know you got a hard stop, and I wanted to talk about this today before it gets buried down in our stack. This is ridiculous. A San Diego man is the first in the U.S. to be charged with smuggling greenhouse gases.
What? Is this illegal?
Well, they're calling it smuggling greenhouse gases.
Did they use someone's Snapchat picture there?
I don't know what this is. So he's smuggling greenhouse gases into the U.S. from Mexico. I don't know if he brought it in balloons or like what.
One of those big capture masks that you invented.
Go ahead, Charlie.
All right. A man has been arrested and charged in San Diego for smuggling greenhouse gases into the United States, marking the first prosecution of its kind in the country from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Southern California. Michael Hart, a 58-year-old San Diego resident, is accused of bringing hydrofluorocarbons, chemical compounds commonly used for refrigeration and air conditioning, from Mexico to the U.S. and selling them for a profit, which violates regulations set in 2020 to slow climate change under the American Innovation and Manufacturing Act. The AIM Act gives the Environmental Protection Agency the authority to reduce production and consumption nationwide of hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, since they have been identified as one of the most potent greenhouse gases emitted into the atmosphere and contributing to rising temperatures. Now, is this the light bulbs? No, HFCs?
No, those are, this is Freon.
Oh.
No.
That you couldn't get in your air conditioner.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to talk about this.
That's right.
Yeah.
At this point, smuggling HFCs into the U.S. is illegal, and officials are working to phase down new manufacturing of the compounds within the country. More restrictions on the use of certain HFCs will take effect next year. Hart faces 13 separate charges, including conspiracy, importation contrary to law, multiple counts of selling imported merchandise contrary to law, and criminal forfeiture. He could face decades in prison if convicted on any one of the charges related to illegal importation. Quote, it is illegal to import certain refrigerants into the United States because of their documented and significantly greater contribution to climate change, said Assistant Attorney General Todd Kim of the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division. We are committed to enforcing the AIM Act and other laws that seek to prevent environmental harm. This guy's also going to go away for a long time just on the sheer fact of setting precedent.
Yeah.
To make sure other people don't do it. My God.
Decades in prison.
Climate change.
For smuggling Freon, and it's bad for the environment, according to some studies. And so I'm not even saying that it's good for the environment or whatever, but they decided that this is such a big problem that it warrants arresting this guy, charging him with 13 separate, I guess, felonies is what it would be, that the EPA, by the way, made the rules on. They passed this law in December of 2020. Oh, Trump was still president, December 2020. They passed this law, and then the law directed the EPA to make the rules. And so the EPA made the rules, and they are now following those rules. And this guy could face decades in prison because he wanted to bring Freon. Now, why would you want to bring Freon into the country? Because there is a massive market for Freon in this country.
You probably would have bought some.
I would have. I looked online for Freon. It was very expensive to buy.
You could have gone to prison.
So the rules, no, you can buy Freon in America, but it has to be Freon that was already in America. It can't be newly made, so you can sell the existing supply of Freon that there is in America. Mm. But it's been banned.
And it's like Bitcoin.
It's very expensive. Yeah. So my AC unit went out.
You should have bought the dip.
Because a coil broke, and it lost all the Freon. They said, yeah, we could replace the coil for like $100, but the Freon will cost about $5,000 to replace it. So at that point, I'm talking over $5,000 to fix my existing air conditioning unit.
That would have cost a couple $100 just a few years ago.
$200 for them to fix it. Instead, I spent $8,000 on a new unit, because why would you spend $5,000 to replace a coil and refill an old unit that's been there since 2006 when you can just spend $8,000 and get a brand new unit? You know, that's going to save me so much money on electricity probably after I get that.
And on your car insurance.
Yeah, by switching to this HVAC unit. Yeah. And I've had nothing but problems with this unit, by the way, since I got it. It's been total BS.
Really?
My heat hardly... I mean, it goes out every year. It's been terrible.
It's still under warranty?
And so the reason this guy's doing this...
Do you have warranty on that?
Yeah, they haven't charged us anything for fixing it, but they've had to come out several times.
Good.
The reason it's so expensive is because they can only sell the existing supply of Freon. And people are trying to smuggle it in from Mexico so they can sell it. You can buy Freon. You just can't import it from other countries and sell it. It can only be what's already here. And why is this such a big market? Because there are millions of people with air conditioners that were made before the year 2015 or whenever it was that don't want to go buy a new HVAC unit and spend $7,000 or $8,000 to fix something that should have cost $200. 10 years ago to fix.
That's right.
And this guy could end up going to prison for decades.
He's going to. It's going to set an example.
To try, and I know he's trying to make money, but to try and help someone like me who didn't want to spend $8,000 on a new HVAC unit that would have wanted to buy Freon from somewhere on the market to save that money.
Love you, bye.
Charlie's out of here. All right, that's all I wanted to say about that. Anyway... Coming up, we're going to have a couple great interviews. One of them is about DEI, where it could be right and where it's gone wrong. Then we're going to talk about AI and a wealth tax proposal in California. And then, of course, Dumb Leap of the Week on Liberty at Night.
This hour of Free Talk Live is brought to you by Dash Digital Cash. Dash is the cryptocurrency designed to be used for spending. In addition to being one of the world's first cryptocurrencies, Dash was the first crypto project to have a decentralized autonomous organization that to this day continues to improve and promote Dash. Every month, 10% of the mining rewards go into a treasury. Anyone with one Dash to spend can put forward a proposal to the Dash masternodes. The masternodes vet the proposals and decide which ones move forward and are funded by that treasury. Nowadays, DAOs are plentiful, but Dash paved the way by doing it first, nearly a decade ago. Dash is one of the oldest cryptocurrencies and is widely available on exchanges, including the decentralized Maya protocol, and in multi-crypto wallets. It's easy to get and use Dash. Start by learning more at Dash.org. Thanks to the Dash DAO for sending us 32 Dash per month to promote Dash on the air. Visit Dash.org to learn about Dash. Dash.org.
Free Talk Live.
What's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? Once again, another fantastic episode of Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. Every Tuesday night, you can find us on Liberty at Night on the Free Talk Live Network, wherever it is that you're listening to us right now. Maybe it's on the Free Talk Live podcast channel, or maybe you're listening somewhere on a highway on the radio station. I don't know. But if you wanted to know, we also go by another name. And me and Charlie, we go by another name called Good Morning Liberty. On Good Morning Liberty, we talk life, liberty, and the pursuit of meaning. That's our tagline. Pretty cool, right? Every single day of the week when we want to. That's right. Almost every single day of the week, you can get a brand new episode delivered straight to your phone. 1,193 episodes so far. That's a lot of episodes. So we cover the news every single day of the week when we want to, because sometimes we don't want to, and that's fine. We're libertarians. It means we don't have to do it. No one's forcing us to do it. And so if you feel the same way, then you want to go find us. And by the way, you can join what we call the Fed Haters Club. Those are the people that subscribe and they hang out live in our private Discord channel every day of the week. When we do an episode, we go live and you can chat back and forth with us. We'll talk to you during the show. You get a shout out, stuff like that. You can suggest topics and correct us if we ever say anything wrong. Good luck trying to find that, you know. But anyway, you want to make sure you go to joingmail.com for that. Like I said, it's Good Morning Liberty with Nate and Charlie. And Charlie is not here right now, but I am joined by Mr. Isaac Willauer, who's a senior at Grove City College and a journalist focusing on race culture and American conservatism. Isaac, how you doing?
Hey, Nate, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on the show, man.
I'm glad you're here. I'm excited to talk about this. Now, for some of our listeners who might not have heard of you before or seen you before, why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory? Like, what brought you to where you are right now? Every single important event that happened in your life, if you could sum that up in like less than a minute.
45 seconds.
Yeah. How did you get here?
No, we'll do that. No, fantastic. Yeah. No, so I was born in India. I was adopted at a year and a half, and I've lived in America for last summer was 20 years. So that's a fun little milestone. I'm a senior at Grove City College in Western Pennsylvania. I study political science and psychology. I'm a journalist. I've covered issues from war in Ukraine to the death row in Florida. And as of recently, I've kind of taken a deeper dive into issues of race, conservatism, and a lot of that, obviously, as we're going to talk about, has morphed into some pretty outspoken criticism of the DEI lobby, that kind of thing. So that's where I found myself right now.
Yeah, so you had an article that was published by the Daily Wire, so congrats on that. That's a big deal. Fairly big publication, from my understanding, so congrats.
Yeah.
It was called Three Things My Future Children Need to Know About Race. And obviously, DEI is a really big topic right now. Sometimes I think it's too big of a topic, but you know, it's something.
No, decidedly.
Yeah, it's something that a lot of people are talking about for sure. So I was gonna try and get your stance on, like, if you think there's good things about this DEI push or this DEI culture right now, and then we'll get into the bad stuff also.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's a really good way to kick things off. So I obviously am conservative, right? I'm not white, obviously. And so this kind of gives me a unique angle into the way DEI works. And I know there are a lot of people who just absolutely straight up, just across the board, there is nothing good about DEI. And I mean, I think in terms of a lot of the modern iterations of it, we can probably make that case, right? It's doing more harm than good. I think we can have that case. Now, I think in theory, and I've interviewed DEI practitioners before, I think in theory there probably is a helpful way to do DEI in terms of, like, what DEI basically does is it looks for, whether it's in a business or it's in a college or anywhere else, is it looks for racial disparities and looks for explanations for those disparities. On its face, that's pretty innocuous, right? Like, that's a perfectly legitimate goal. It's where it goes from there and the answers that it comes up with that are problems. So I think, is it possible for a school, a business, a college to just be data-driven in that way and to just focus on and to just be meritocratically focused and also do DEI? Do I think that's possible in theory? Of course it's possible in theory. My concern is not only that a lot of times it doesn't happen that way in practice, but people are, even DEI practitioners, are disincentivized from practicing it that way, right? So there's a right way to do it that's very data focused in this kind of thing and aimed at increasing workplace cohesion. But then there's the really, really, really popular version of it that does none of those things and tends to divide people and tends to focus on buzzwords as opposed to actual business function. I think that's where the problem lies.
Now, some of the criticisms of DEI, of course, I mean, I have some, probably the same as you. I tend to support just a merit-based system. Like that's the system I want to go towards. And if you happen to have that DEI department, they find, well, people are getting held out and it's because of some kind of racism or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that that's clearly that is a good thing. The biggest criticism would be, could you be holding out other people that might be better on the merit? I don't know. Now, the other thing I want to ask you is this anti-DEI push, have you seen instances where it has actually gone too far?
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. I mean, I'm trying to think of a good... Okay, so the best corporate example I can think of right now is Chick-fil-A, right? So Chick-fil-A has a DEI office, and that's... And people raise just an absolute hue and cry about this is the worst thing ever. And this business, which has been a stalwart conservative business for a very long time, has been the evangelical favorite. Now they have a DEI office. We can't support them. Boycott, run screaming into a wall, which is always a great strategy, right? I think, and I looked into that. And when you read the DEI page of a place like Chick-fil-A, it's not DEI in the way that we currently understand it, right? Chick-fil-A is doing, as is the case with many things in business, Chick-fil-A is doing things very differently than a lot of modern businesses, right? It's about creating an environment that's welcoming to people of all cultures, this kind of thing. If that was what all DEI was, we would not be sitting here having this conversation about DEI. It's quite simple, and there wouldn't be this massive cultural pushback. So yeah, can anti-DEI people shoot too quickly, get the wrong target? Is that possible? Of course it's possible. It happens all the time. But that doesn't mean that the criticisms of much of the modern kind of pop DEI lobby are misplaced, I think.
One instance where I get really annoyed is we had this rash of issues that happened in the airline industry and the FAA, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And this is around the same time I think the big anti-DEI push was happening. And if I just paid attention to what people were tweeting or posting on X, it would seem like every problem that happened was caused because DEI forced the company to hire a minority over the higher merit-based white person who didn't get the job, and therefore the door fell off the plane or something like that.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, and so every single thing that happens, like, whoa, this is what happens when you have DEI. And I'm like, I feel like you need to examine every single instance and figure out what actually happened. You know, maybe someone just did a bad job that day and it's not because of DEI programs, you know?
And that's a perfectly, and the whole door seal thing. I mean, that's a meritocratic argument. It doesn't matter what race you are. The door fell off the plane. I mean, come on. It doesn't matter if it was a white person or a black person. That is just, it should be a not at Boeing person. That should be the rule that we should be looking for. So yeah, I think there we can definitely see excesses, and we shouldn't tolerate those excesses or act like they're okay in pursuance of a broader cultural goal. But I think, and the point I made in the Daily Wire piece, is that much of modern DEI is not animated solely by a practice, but by a philosophy, and a philosophy of skepticism about America's ability to do racial reconciliation, and a profoundly pessimistic narrative about our ability to coexist as people of different ethnicities, which I think is really pernicious and toxic.
Yeah, I was going to mention, like, I was kind of raised with the idea that it feels weird to say it, but that you... this idea that you don't see people's races and skin colors and ethnicities, and that you treat everyone just like they're a human being with life experiences like you, and we all have these life experiences, and that's made us the person that we are right now. And it kind of seems like that idea right now makes me racist, possibly, for saying that. One of these things that you listed in the piece was that you didn't want to go through life viewing everything through a racial lens, that wasn't the right way. That wasn't the way that you wanted to do it. So I don't know if you got any ideas on that.
Yeah, no, that's very true. It's a very interesting point, because it's like, yeah, basically I was raised more or less the same. It's in terms of, obviously there are times when we need to see race, because when issues of racial preference or prejudice are being brought up, obviously we need to look at race and see what's going on there. That's not, when people say they don't see race, I think a lot of people who are maybe more on the anti-racist, pro-DEI train, when they hear people say they don't see race, they take that to mean, well, you're just ignorant to racism, right? You're just ignoring the epidemic of white supremacy. That's not what it means at all, right? In a charitable reading of that, what that means is, and in my opinion, generally the right reading of that, it means that I don't view life primarily or even really secondarily through racial lenses. I see them through moral and philosophical and human lenses. I spent some time, especially like a little bit in high school, thinking about life through maybe a more racial lens than I do now. And I will tell you, it didn't exactly do wonders for my mental health. It doesn't exactly do you any great service to sit around thinking about all the ways in which you're different from everybody else around you. Turns out that's never really a helpful way to view life. And it makes you more depressed. And I will say, this is no offense to some of the DEI practitioners that I've interviewed, because some of them are wonderful people. They clearly care about meritocratic things. I think they're misled, but I think they care. But a lot of people I know who are very on board with the DEI machine, very on board with the anti-racism train, right? Their outlooks on life, I hear them explain their outlooks on life, and they're so depressing. They're so pessimistic. And I'm like, is this what we're supposed to sell young Americans, especially Americans of color? Like, I don't want my future son or daughter to bump into any of these people because it's just going to depress and annoy them. I think we can do better than that. And I think that is the really pernicious thing about DEI right now, is that it's rooted in that sentiment of skepticism about whether or not America is actually great, skepticism about whether or not America can actually work for people of all colors. We have come so far as a nation. Is this really the time for skepticism on this issue? I don't think so. And skepticism where it is not warranted is a very, very quick path to nihilism, I think.
Before we go any further, I got to tell y'all, I messed up. I started a savings account a few years ago. I put $5,000 in it, and I never looked at it again. I don't even know why. That $5,000, because of inflation, is now worth $4,145. That's not good. The government punishes you for keeping your wealth, your money, your cash in the savings account. How? That's through inflation. Inflation is a tax on savers. It's a systematic erosion of your wealth. Items that cost $10 today might cost $15 tomorrow, but your savings account will still have the same amount of money in it, meaning it's losing purchasing power. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured over $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. This is exciting because gold can be a hedge against inflation. Gold remains steady when inflation's on the rise. The dollar's in turmoil. Gold can be a defense against economic downturn. Unlike money, gold can't be printed. It's your shield in times of economic uncertainty. Gold's value doesn't just hold, it increases during inflationary periods. To find out more, go to noblegoldinvestments.com/GML. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/GML.
Well, yeah, I mean, I tried to imagine being told as I was growing up that it didn't matter what I did, that society was going to hold me back and I wouldn't be able to make it anywhere. Like, why would you ever try after that? Like, that seems like a self-perpetuating cycle of keeping people down by just telling them that there's no point in even trying because the system's going to hold you down, right?
Yeah, well, then let's also take a look at who are the people that the DEI lobby is really rallying behind right now. Claudine Gay, really? She's the person. Like, I don't want my daughter to be told you can be just like Claudine Gay. Call me crazy. That is not a helpful thing to tell anybody, especially if she's going to college. That's going to be a real problem. I don't want the DEI lobby, unfortunately, has a habit. I'm not going to say everybody does it. It has a habit of picking the worst role models, like Claudine Gay, and holding them up as examples either of virtuous resistance to the system or as virtuous victims to the system. And I'm sorry, is Claudine Gay the best that we have? Really? I don't think so. And I think that needs to be dealt with.
One thing I really worry about, and this really comes from all sides, a lot of it from the anti-DEI side too, is that ideas like this I'm worried can actually lead to more racism, where I felt like we were on a really good path as a country throughout my lifetime. And when you have things like a DEI push and a hiring program and the idea, I'm not even saying that it specifically is happening, but the idea pushed out to people that you're going to hire someone because of their race and not hire someone else because of their race, that we're going to lead to a more racist society where you have, like, going back to the airline thing, people saying, oh, if I go into an airplane and I see the pilots are black, I'm getting off of there. And that's not the direction that we want to go. And unfortunately, that's what happens when you don't, when you don't have a purely merit-based system. You know, you fear those kind of things. When I walk onto a plane and I see the pilots are black and I'm like, okay, well, you have a purely merit-based system. That means that they beat out all of the other candidates that they are and they're the best possible pilots. But when that creeps into your mind that, well, what if they're hired because they're black?
I mean, it's socially corrosive on both ends, right? So it's socially corrosive on your end seeing that, because if you, not you, but like you generally, if people start thinking that way, that is a woe to all of the qualified black airline pilots. Oh my goodness. What does this do for you? It's because one thing, it destroys your customers' confidence in you, but also kind of destroys your own ability to be confident in yourself. Because not only do you have to ask yourself, oh my gosh, maybe I did get this position because I'm black, but you then have to also ask yourself, wait, does everybody think that I got this position because I'm black? It is unfortunately, like, we have enough problems with imposter syndrome of people who want to do better, right? We don't need to be compounding it by giving people the notion that maybe everything you accomplish in your life is due to your skin color. Maybe that's what it is. Oh, and also, by the way, everything bad that you encounter in your life is also because of your skin color. So, like, have fun with that. These are profoundly soul-destroying ideas. They are very, very, to use the social science term, stupid. They don't help anybody. And I look at this, and the reason I titled the Daily Wire piece the thing that I did was because I hear all the time, and I get MSNBC and the Boston Globe, or the two pieces I linked in the article, this assumption that people who are anti-DEI are doing this out of some kind of racial animus, or because we are all white supremacists, or because we all love the Klan, or because we all want to hold black Americans down and hold Americans of color down and act as if the 1950s, the bad parts, or the 1850s, the bad parts, are the times that we want to return to. This is nonsense, right? We are critiquing DEI because it doesn't help us. We are critiquing DEI because we care about future generations of Americans of color, and we are concerned about the influence of well-intentioned but profoundly misled Americans who are going to tell them that focusing on race and racial differences is the way to become a happier, healthier person. It doesn't. We're not doing this out of some kind of animus. We're doing this because we care. We're doing this because we care about the future of America. And we care about the story that we're telling other people, not only about America, but the story that they will then tell themselves. It behooves us to give them a good story, because it is a good story in many, many important ways.
So what should we do then, or what should corporations do? What should people in power do to fix this problem? Like, I don't think that you want to get rid of, you know, all DEI that there is out there, at least on its original idea.
No, although Ben Sasse's little test run at University of Florida, we get to see how that goes. So I'm sure that'll turn up some interesting test cases. I'm not going to opine about that. But yeah, I don't want to ban it outright. I don't think that's necessarily the way. I think it's because that involves federal government action, which are just terrible words, just in general. And I think that kind of decision should be left up to, if you're a business and you truly believe that that you can do DEI right, go for it, man. I got no problem with that. I don't care. Now, if you do it wrong, I mean, you deserve to be ridiculed and made fun of and probably lose money for it. But that's another issue. I think in terms of what can people do, I mean, one, hold DEI people accountable. So there's this whole snafu in Oklahoma where Governor Stitt signs this order saying that banning certain forms of DEI. Nicole Hannah-Jones said it was racist. Basically, what this Oklahoma order did was say that you cannot call for preferential treatment based on race. That is not a controversial ask. That is an ask that every DEI office in the country should be able to comply with and should already be complying with. And if that if that elicits pushback, the question then becomes why? Why are you pushing back to that? You can't be racist. Why are you upset that you can't be racist? Oh, that's not good. So there's that, right? I think when it comes to governmental action, that kind of thing, I think is perfectly fine. I have no problem with that. I think that is perfectly in keeping with the character of American law and in the character of the American experiment. That makes sense. So that's what corporations can do, is they can root out all preferential treatment of race of any kind, right? Which is what we want, which is what meritocracy really is. But I think at the more individual level, I mean, we need to be very discerning with the narratives on race that we send to people, right? We need to be very careful that we're not ignoring America's historical sins. We're not trying to create historical curriculums that erase such things. But we also need to not tell everybody that America is a terrible racist country. There is in fact a wide spectrum between those two things. There is absolutely no reason. Like, I had someone ask me just the other day, who's like a DEI advocate, right? And they asked me, you know, do you have to choose between teaching systemic racism and teaching white supremacy? I'm like, are those my only options? Really? They're not my only options, it turns out. And our future generations of Americans deserve better than that kind of reductionist, simplistic, stupid, anti-racist dichotomy.
I completely agree. And I think that's a good place for us to end it, because you just gave people a lot of good things to think about. Unless you have something else you want to add on this, but that felt pretty good to me.
Yeah, no, so, that's great.
All right,
cool. The message that Americans need to hear.
Good, good. So, Isaac, where can people go to find more of your work?
Yeah, so go to youngvoices.org. If you want to follow me specifically, I'm on Twitter at ISAACWILLOUR, or on X. Sorry, it's not Twitter anymore.
can we all
it's
revolt?
Still Twitter
can
to
we
me.
All agree to revolt against that and just call it Twitter? You think? I mean, that's something
that's
we can
what
all,
I do.
That's what we can that's all agree.
I'm on. I'm never going to call it an X. I'm never going to call it an X post. That's creepy and weird.
Yeah, it's really weird. You should never change the name of something that's been turned into a verb. You know, that's
yeah,
you know,
when no, you tweet that's true. Something, yeah. Tweets are fun. Posts are boring.
Yeah, that sounds really boring. All right, Isaac, come on anytime. You know, send me an email. This is a great conversation, and we'd love to have you back.
Absolutely, Nate. Thanks so much. God bless.
Okay, coming right up, we're going to be talking about AI, the dangers, the benefits. Are we all going to get killed by AI? I don't know. Mr. Benjamin Ianian is going to be talking to us. Coming right up, then we'll do Dumb Bleep of the Week on Liberty Tonight on the Free Talk Live Network.
Protection. Eleutheromania. The insatiable desire for freedom.
Filibuster. Police state.
It's the new 3-song heavy metal EP from Captain Kickass. Available now on your favorite music app, or get it directly from CaptainKickass.com.
It's Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network. I'm going to do this interview here with Benjamin Ianian. We're going to talk about AI and taxes.
So anyway, man, we got a couple articles here in the stack to talk about. The first one has to do with AI, and I wanted to ask you this pressing question. I'm worried about it. Is AI going to kill us all?
No, I certainly don't think AI is going to kill us all. I do understand the concerns, especially because, you know, this is a new technology. Whenever we see, you know, new technologies being developed, it's very normal to see the citizenry react with fear and come up with these hypothetical situations, these doomsday scenarios. And one that we see a lot is what you just mentioned, is that AI is going to kill us all. We're going to go extinct as a result of these different models. And I think that Marc Andreessen, who's a very, you know, well-renowned venture capitalist, a very successful guy, he wrote a great piece that I would recommend people look up about AI last year. And there's a quote that I just want to read from that real quick. He wrote, AI is math, code, computers. built by people, owned by people, used by people, controlled by people. The idea that it will at some point develop a mind of its own and decide that it has motivations that lead it to try to kill us is a superstitious hand wave. And I think that that really hits the nail on the head. You know, it's software built on top of hardware, made by humans. We're the ones that control it. I don't foresee it causing a mass extinction event.
Okay, I feel better now. I watched Terminator a bunch of times when I was growing up. And so, you know, I've always been worried about this inevitable machine takeover. But if you say so, I'll go ahead and place that one on the back burner to the a more pressing question, the more down-to-earth question that we hear, which is that AI is going to lead to mass unemployment. It's going to steal everyone's jobs. Is that something that people should be worried about with AI?
Yeah, that's always a concern. The transition from a place of, you know, status quo or current day, you know, the transition to a new world with some revolutionary technology, the transition can be bumpy. You know, there are going to be people that lose their jobs during that transition. But what we've seen throughout history is that technological development has been able to increase prosperity, increase job growth over time. As of now, I don't think we have any reason to believe that artificial intelligence will be any different. And fears of unemployment have been unemployment resulting from technological development. Specifically, those fears have been around since technological development has been around. You know, I also recommend people take a look at, there's a page on the Cato Institute website, which is a libertarian think tank, as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of. Jeffrey Muron has a great page where he lists, you know, quotes and examples of all different types of fears relating to unemployment from technology all throughout history, stemming back from, as far back as I believe, you know, maybe 700 AD, I think is as far back as his list goes. It might even be sooner, but there have been Roman emperors who quashed various technological developments for fear of unemployment. There's actually one that he points to. A Roman emperor ordered that an inventor be killed because he was fearful his invention would cause unemployment. We've seen, you know, queens of England do the same thing. One more, you know, good example, I think, is in 1989, the International Metal Workers Federation actually predicted that within 30 years, as little as 2% of all of the current labor force would be needed to produce all goods and services necessary. Well, we are far past 30 years since that prediction, and the global unemployment rate is in the single digits. So I don't think we have any reason to think that AI will be any different, but I definitely understand those fears a little bit more.
One thing that only ever leads me to fear things like this is the environment that makes it more difficult for new industries to pop up. You know, that's something that you would really want when AI does come in and replace some workers in some specific industry, is that you want it to be as easy as possible for new jobs to be created and a new industry to be created. And the more we, the more regulations and laws that we have that make that more difficult, the closer we get to the situation that people are afraid of, right?
I think you just hit the nail on the head. People should be more worried about government policy and regulations that restrict the growth of the economy and of business creation than they should be about technological innovation. You know, we shouldn't have crippling regulations, unnecessary compliance costs, you know, put on, you know, possible new entrants into various fields. That's what slows down job growth. That's exactly what makes the transition with revolutionary technology more difficult. Our energy should be focused on repealing unnecessary regulations and freeing up our economy so that we can have that job growth that results from this innovation.
Now, one thing that I honestly had not thought about at all until I read your piece in realclearenergy.org is the environmental impacts of AI. I didn't even know that there was such a thing. I guess now that I think about it, there would be a lot of energy consumed from the companies that are making these products. But what are people saying about that right now?
Yeah, there's been a lot of concern with environmental impacts from artificial intelligence. And it just as you said, the more compute that there is out in the world, the more energy usage that we'll see, at least in the immediate future. And so people have been really worried about CO2 emissions as they're related to this technology. Now, we've also seen that with other new technologies. For example, Bitcoin. People were really worried that Bitcoin mining was going to cause massive, CO2 emissions. And we've actually seen, various reports by massive even consulting firms talking about how Bitcoin can be great for the environment, can help, the development of renewable energy. And so I think artificial intelligence kind of falls into that category. There's a lot of early fear. And I think over time, we're going to see that A, on net, it's going to be good for the environment, but also that even in the short term, it's not as bad for the environment as everyone is worrying. And so, what we're seeing right now is people trying to study the CO2 emissions as they are linked to model development and model usage. And so one example that a recent report by the Center for Data Innovation highlighted was a research report at the University of Massachusetts Amherst that estimated, that that training a specific model that they looked at would generate about 626,000 pounds of CO2. They were looking at a model that would help with, I believe it was English to German translations and vice versa. But anyway, that amount of CO2 is comparable to around 300 round trip flights from the East to West Coast. And the developers of this model saw these, calculations, these estimations, and in response, they decided to, release a summary of their energy use and really detail their work how much energy they were using as a result of it. And it turns out that the actual emissions from training that model were about 88 times smaller than the estimates reported by the team at University of Massachusetts Amherst. So that's just one example that it's really hard to get good data on, the energy usage of different models, especially when you're estimating from the outside. I think we need to be careful about letting these different reports, especially, ones coming from think tanks, universities, where they're doing these estimations from the outside. We have to question how good is their data, because it's really hard to estimate the impact of these things.
I'm just shocked right now that there was a model that was created that ended up being wrong as it pertains to CO2 emissions. I didn't know that you were such a climate denier. I don't know if we can talk about these kinds of things on here. The other thing, you mentioned that there would be innovations and new efficiencies, and actually, couldn't AI help create some of those things? I mean, maybe there is a whole other way of generating energy that this mythical computer is just going to come up with for us. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching a little bit there, but it would be kind of ironic if we ended up stopping ourselves from creating energy innovations that could help solve the climate crisis that people are trying to prevent.
Yeah, over time, there's two prongs really to answering that question. First is the efficiency of AI models themselves. Over time, we can expect the efficiency of these models to improve, which we've already been seeing. Even when they're growing in size and complexity, the rate of their energy consumption is not necessarily growing at the same rate as the models themselves. And over time, we should see better efficiency related to the hardware that's involved in actually creating these models. And so on top of seeing better efficiency with the models themselves, we also can expect that AI will help us solve environmental challenges. They can analyze large sets of data, far better than the technology that we've had in the past. That can help us conserve water. That can help us combat huge crises like wildfires. It can help us optimize our energy usages in a lot of ways by analyzing, the current systems that we employ. And so the ability to analyze large sets of data and really sift through information much quicker could theoretically help us improve the environment. So I actually don't think that's theoretical at all. We're already seeing it. And so I think people need to take that into account when they're worrying about the environmental impact of AI. AI could help us drastically improve our environmental impact.
Now, one thing before we move on and take a hard shift over to California and wealth taxes, before we move on, the scariest thing in AI that I've seen so far was that Google Gemini thing. I mean, that's actually the closest thing to destroying society I've seen so far. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that was definitely a bit concerning, seeing how much bias was baked into that model. And that is a real concern I think people need to think about with AI, specifically LLMs. There's a huge conflation, or I guess not necessarily conflation, but AI is used as this umbrella term that people just assume are LLMs that we use every day, because that's what the average day consumer comes into contact with. It's ChatGPT, it's Gemini, it's Grok, it's things of that nature. But AI is not just LLMs, but the LLMs that we use, we really do need to be mindful of, because they are created by humans. They are baked in, they do have the bias baked in of the people who create them. And so the biggest risk that I see from the consumer focused chatbot models is people ascribing a godlike presence to these models, where they just believe what's spit out to them, where they buy whatever it tells them, whatever answer it gives them has to be the holy grail. I think we need to continue to be skeptical of the answers we receive, just like we are when we Google something online. You click on the first article that pops up, you're not going to immediately believe what it tells you. You might ask follow-up questions. You might research a little bit more, see what other viewpoints there are out there. And so I think we need to maintain that healthy skepticism of the information we receive, even from large LLMs. And I think that Gemini was provided a great example that when you would type in the name of founding father and you'd want a picture of George Washington, he might come out black. Or you might type in the name of some other historical figure who was black or white or whatever, and they might come out Asian. So they're definitely, it's a bit of a ridiculous example, because I don't think anyone would have predicted that it would be that far off, but it's a great reminder that these models are still fallible, just like the human beings that program them.
I think a great thing to take away from it was that the market actually worked. Google pulled that Gemini feature of making those photos, and they have enough competition in the market that everyone knew that it was completely ridiculous and that they weren't going to use it to generate their photos. And they're going to be extremely skeptical of the answers it's giving, because we have so much great competition, other options out there that we can go to. So I think that's a win for the market.
Absolutely. Consumer pressure, consumer feedback at the end of the day will direct what companies do with their products. And if a product is so biased that it becomes unusable, it's not going to survive in the market. And so over time, hopefully these different LLMs or, image generators will become better, because people want, consumers to be able to use them gainfully.
Now, the next topic here, if we got enough time to do that, if you're okay with that, is this California wealth tax idea. Now, they got a potential $68 billion deficit. I'm confused, because I thought they had a massive surplus like last year, and now they have a giant deficit, and people are kicking around the idea of a wealth tax, I guess. What's going on there?
Yeah, the deficit was a bit of a surprise for some. There's been a huge revenue shortfalls in the state, and they spend like drunken sailors, much like our federal government does in a lot of ways. So in that context, staring down this possibly huge budget deficit in the upcoming year, the California legislature was set to discuss the possibility of implementing a wealth tax. Now, thankfully, the bill that was being discussed ended up stalling in committee after Gavin Newsom, surprise, surprise, actually came out strongly in opposition to the bill. However, it still should worry us that these conversations continue to pop up. It's not going anywhere. California will discuss it again at some time soon. Maybe Gavin Newsom, if he's not eyeing the presidency a little bit out of the corner of his eye. Maybe he won't be so quick to oppose a wealth tax in the future. You never know when the political landscape can change. So we definitely need to be cognizant of this possibility, because it's going to pop up at the federal level, as you know, you see federal politicians bring up the possibility of a wealth tax all the time. So it's definitely something that needs to be discussed.
I actually, I don't think Gavin Newsom would ever go with it, because he tends to do the bidding of his friends and his family in the legislature. So I'm guessing that had something to do with him being against this idea. How impractical is a wealth tax to actually implement? Some people think that you're just going to look at a piece of paper. It says how much wealth there is, and then you're going to put a tax on that person. Here's how much they owe you. But it's not quite like that, right?
A wealth tax is highly impractical. It's incredibly hard to implement, and the state that implements it will incur huge administrative costs, because there are going to be disputes between the wealthy and the tax collectors about the valuation of their assets. And to value assets that aren't publicly traded, it's much harder. You know, it's not just valuing stock. Okay, you pull up, the S&P 500, and you can figure out how much they're holding in the S&P 500 is worth. That's pretty easy. But when we're talking about shares in private companies, or we're talking about art or boats or homes, those things are not as easily valued, and there's going to be disputes, you know, between what is reported and what the tax collectors think that should have been reported. And so it costs a lot of money to value these assets and to collect the taxes associated with them. And then on top of it being impractical, it's also terrible for the economy. When you tax something, you disincentivize that thing. You know, we see politicians try and tax nicotine because they don't want people smoking cigarettes as much. Now, that just drives it underground. It becomes a black market. It doesn't necessarily get rid of it, but it does disincentivize some people from engaging in that activity. When you raise the cost of something, the demand for it, you know, goes down, at least marginally. So it's going to disincentivize wealth creation. It's also going to incentivize people to leave whatever state implements it. You know, we've seen this all throughout the last 100 years. There used to be about four times as many European countries who had wealth taxes as they do now. Most of them got rid of them because they're hard to implement. The wealthy left and their countries became poorer. So it really is not only impractical, it's also terrible from a consequentialist standpoint. It harms the economy within the area that it's implemented.
The other thing that you make a point to mention, which is the point of the article, which I love, is that it's also immoral, which is something that we lose sight of sometimes. We can talk all day about how this wouldn't be able to work, about how it wouldn't be implemented. That leaves open the idea that if the right person got an office and you hired the right people to do this for you, that then it would be a good idea. But it's also still immoral.
Exactly. So it's impractical. It's also bad for economic growth, bad for jobs. We just talked about artificial intelligence. Well, if you want job growth, you should oppose a wealth tax, because you don't want productive members of society leaving because they are avoiding the tax. Job growth will suffer. But we shouldn't only look at the consequences of this policy. We should actually look at it based on principle as well. And so, in my article, I take the stance that it is immoral to implement a wealth tax. And I really looked at the California situation for a couple of reasons. So one, a wealth tax violates this notion of the rule of law that we have, that no policy should work to the detriment of a specific group or for the benefit of a specific group. Laws should be neutral on their face, and they should not be working to engender certain social outcomes, let's say, for particular groups. That is not, the proper role of the government. So it violates the rule of law. That's one way in which it violates morality. And then it's also wrong to employ coercion to take citizens' property when there are completely viable alternatives. Now, as a libertarian, I believe in the saying that taxation is theft. But I'm a libertarian. I'm not an anarchist. So I do recognize there's going to be some level of taxation. But the idea that taxation is theft means the threshold that has to be met for it to be justified is incredibly high. And so when there are huge, you know, very, very viable alternatives to taking citizens' money to fix, let's say, a budget deficit in California, that's when it becomes deeply immoral to employ coercion to take that money. And, you know, so a lot of people ask, well, how is it coercive? Well, all taxes are backed by the implicit threat of violence, imprisonment, or fines. That's how the government elicits, you know, our cooperation. And so not only does it violate the rule of law, but implementing a wealth tax when there's, you know, great viable alternatives like cutting spending, there's a lot of failing programs in California that they could cut back on. It is deeply immoral to turn to your citizens and say, I'm going to take your money instead of reducing the spending that I've been putting forward.
And cutting spending, that is a novel idea that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about lately. So what else? I mean, you were telling me beforehand, you got something else that you're working on right now, a book, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have a book coming out hopefully in the next week or two. It's a self-published book. I have an author's copy on the way where I can approve the final edits of it. But it's about how progressive economic policies harm the most vulnerable in society. A lot of times, you know, progressive economic agendas are justified, or at least they attempt to justify them by saying they're working to help the little guy, you know, the most vulnerable, the poor, the working class. They claim that they are the champion of those people. And so I decided to write a very short book about the most hotly debated progressive economic policies and explain how they harm the most vulnerable.
Nice. I love the idea. We've been telling people for a while that they should take the moral high ground, that these people that argue in favor of those policies have taken the moral high ground on them because they're the ones who want to help, when in fact they're the ones that are hurting. And ideas like what libertarians have are actually the most moral ideas and the best way to help the most amount of people. So love the idea. And what's, you got a name? What's the name of it?
Yeah. So the title is Beyond Intention. The full title is Beyond Intention, How Progressive Economic Policy Initiatives Harm the Most Vulnerable.
Awesome. And you're going to send me a copy when that's finished up, right?
Absolutely. It will be on your doorstep in a nice box, cool, I promise. Cool.
I thought I'd put you on the spot right there. Well, Ben, tell everyone where they can go to follow more of your work.
Yeah, you guys can go to Twitter and follow me at Benjamin Iyanian. That's where I post most of my work. I'm also on Instagram at BIyanian13. I tend to post most of it there as well.
Okay. And just so people listening know, it could also be pronounced Iyanian. There's no real way of knowing. So if that helps you with the spelling, you can think about it that way too. Ben, thank you so much for your time today. Had a great time, great conversation, and we'd love to have you back on soon.
Thanks for having me on. It's great talking with you.
Coming up, you all know what time it is. It's time for Dumb Bleep of the Week. Time to get your votes in. If you're in the live group, join gmail.com, the Fed Haters Club. But if not, you'll just have to listen to what everyone else voted for on Liberty at Night with Nathan Charles.
Free Talk Live.
What's up, all of our liberty-loving friends? This is another fantastic episode of Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network, coming at you from Nashville, Tennessee. And it's time for Dumb Bleep of the Week. We got 10 great ones to go through today. The Fed Haters Club is going to vote. Let's get to it. I don't know if you guys know this, and housing is getting expensive. So the federal government gets people together, like in a bunch of rooms, and they just got teams of people thinking stuff up and people backing them up, and they say, well, we got a problem. Housing's too expensive. And they come up with this novel plan, this crazy idea. So crazy, it just might not work. Get this, Charlie. I'm surprised they came up with this. They're going to try to subsidize the cost of housing for people.
Yeah.
You know,
which will definitely make the cost go down.
A crazy plan. I'm so enthused that they were able to spend all this time thinking about this problem and come up with the idea that the government should try to subsidize the cost of housing to make it more affordable. Mm-hmm. It's, yeah, like Costco said, how did we not think of that? This is nuts. Good job on them. Here we go.
I know the cost of housing is so important to you. If inflation keeps coming down, mortgage rates will come down as well. But I'm not waiting. I want to provide an annual tax credit that will give Americans $400 a month for the next 2 years as mortgage rates come down, to put toward their mortgages when they buy their first home or trade up for a little more space. Just for 2 years. And my administration is also eliminating title insurance on federally backed mortgages. When you refinance your home, you can save $1,000 or more as a consequence.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Why didn't anyone else ever think of that? Listen, housing is expensive. Interest rates are high. And that adds a lot on the cost of a house. Like if you
and
buy
the idea that you should bank on the fact that you're going to get this credit for 2 years and then be able to refinance at a cheaper rate. Mm-hmm. Like we know for sure
that's
in 2 years, the rate's going to be less.
That's a great idea.
Now, if it is, that's good. Refinance. That's great. Awesome. What if it's not? What if it's higher?
That's
and then
the
you
thing.
No longer have the $400 a month.
And great. What we know is when you give people this money, they're saying $400 a month. I don't know if it's going to be a one-time payment or like a credit, and he's just giving you what it is monthly. So they're talking about a tax credit of $5,000 a year for 2 years. The idea is to give first-time buyers a leg up amid soaring home prices and mortgage rates that are close to their highest in decades. A second credit worth $10,000 for a year would go to people who sold their starter home. The measure would have to pass Congress to become a reality. This is not going to do anything to actually fix the underlying problems with housing. Like subsidizing the cost of a house does not fix why the house is so expensive. And even in that speech, he says, look, the Federal Reserve says, you know, as we fix inflation, rates are going to come down. And that's going to fix a big problem with the cost of a house right now. But he says, I'm not going to wait. I'm not going to wait for that. And this is actually a bad thing, because when you throw federal money towards these houses, it's just going to lead to, why would the price come down? That's the question. Why would it come down when you are giving people a credit towards the house? Is the incentive for it to get cheaper, or is the incentive for it to get more expensive after that? What do we know about when the federal government subsidizes things?
I honestly don't know how this is going to help at being a tax credit. So now, is it a refundable tax credit? Meaning,
I don't know.
Like if you don't pay taxes, you'll get that money regardless if you buy a home. So you
Possibly.
Can count that as income. Can you count that as income with a mortgage lender? I don't think so. Everything goes based off what you make gross anyway. They don't care about your taxes.
Yeah.
They take a percentage of your gross income. Doesn't matter what you pay in taxes. So my thing, a couple things is one, I'm always for people getting money back on their taxes.
Sure.
So doesn't matter how you spend it.
Unless it's refundable.
Yeah. And like you're not paying taxes, then you're getting a check from the government. The other thing is, I don't know how this really is going to help in the, like, if you can't afford a bigger house, let's say if you're one of those people trying to get a bigger house, if you can't afford it already anyway, they're going to look at your monthly debt to income ratio. What is the credit going to do? You can't put that on the ledger. I don't think. I'm not a mortgage lender. I don't know. Somebody that lends for homes, let me know, but I'm pretty sure that's not something you put on the income ledger.
Well, plus,
that you're going to get a tax credit.
What's a $5,000 credit for 2 years and a 30-year mortgage? The grand scheme of thing, it's basically nothing. Your underlying point, Charlie, is correct. It's not going to help. That is
right.
That is the actual thing. What you will do is you might get some people into a house, and they might be looking at this $400 a month, if that's what you want to call it. And they might think, well, you know, we're going to be getting that credit, and they're going to be getting it for 2 years. What do you think is going to happen after 2 years, Charlie? And that credit goes away for people.
Yep.
They're no longer getting that. You think the government just says, all right, it's over. Deal with it, loser. And then he just drives off in his convertible. You
what's
think that's
that
what's going to happen?
There's nothing so permanent as a temporary government solution.
He said it's just for 2 years. Mm. The other thing like that we brought up earlier that annoys me about the State of the Union speech is that this is just him saying things. Congress would have to pass this. Yeah. Now, Congress is
it's
not...
It's like he's running for school president.
Yeah. He's just saying things
that
people would
get rid
like.
Of all homework.
Yeah. This is
with an asterisk. You know, the teacher has to comply.
The teacher actually has to do it. Yeah. But this is what I want to do.
That's what I'm running on. That's yeah. what I'm can't vote me as your student yeah. president. And I will make sure all dogs eat homework.
And so when he comes out and he says all these big plans, he says them as if it's something that's actually going to happen. It's a great campaign idea because then you say, well, yeah, that's true, which is why we also need to make sure we win the House and the Senate in 2024.
Yep.
And then you'll finally get all these things that you're really excited about.
Finally be enough.
They do have that $10,000 for people who want to trade up to a better home, leaving their first time. So they're trying to fix one of the big problems, which is that people don't want to leave the home they're in because the interest rates are so high. Like I'm in a home, I'm in my first home right now. I would probably qualify for this $10,000 thing because we're in what would qualify probably as a starter home. And it's our first home. And we don't want to get a new home because why would I want to go pay 7% interest on a mortgage? Yeah. I know, sure, you can refinance when the rates come down, if they ever come down. 7% is still low historically.
Yeah.
So are they going to come down or not? And so we are sitting in our house. So what that does is that actually slows down the supply, your churn rate on those first time homes for people, those starter homes for people, because people don't want to leave the house that they're in right now. So they're trying to find a way to get people to leave the house that they're in so someone else can come in and buy that as their first time home.
So ultimately this is backed by the banks.
Yeah. Yeah. Still.
The banks want you to be moving.
And so, and then when a whole bunch of people get into mortgages that they actually can't afford after this thing expires or whatever, if the Republicans let it expire, because they'll be trying to extend it in 2 years, yep. I guarantee you. And then we have a housing crisis and then it'll be capitalism's fault
right. yeah.
after that. So just keep that in mind.
Also what Dan says here too, 10,000 is nothing. Yeah. What is $10,000 anymore? I mean,
for in terms of a home.
Yeah.
No.
In terms of just regular everyday living, yeah. it's like 10 bucks in your wallet.
You know? Speak for yourself.
yeah. I feel like, you know, I was thinking about the other day, like if I hit a jackpot at the casino for 10 grand, what is that?
Who cares?
What is that going to do? That?
You know what you got to do? You got to pay taxes on it. And then people are bugging you, you know, the borrow yeah. money and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so. Got to pay tax on the car.
Anyway, we just switched in the Shawshank Redemption for a little bit, just in case no one.
What do you think the government's going to do?
They're going to take a big bite out of my ass. That's what they're going to do. Okay, next one. Minimum taxes on corporations and billionaires for dumb leap number two. Number one was the housing idea. Number two, we'll go into the taxes part.
By the way, the first couple years we cut the deficit.
Oh, sorry, the deficit part too, because he's going to talk about how he cut the deficit. So I don't have to cut in. He cut the deficit because the year before he came into office, we had the biggest spending package that had ever happened in the history of the entire world. And so we had, by the way, signed into law by President Donald Trump, a Republican. Mm-hmm. And so he came into office and we didn't have the biggest spending package ever in the history of the world again, right afterwards. And he proposed what would have been an even bigger spending package in the history of the world called the Build Back Better Plan, which was like freaking $4 trillion or something like that.
And Congress didn't pass it.
And it got blocked by Manchin and Sinema, I believe, you know, two senators prevented America being built back better or whatever.
Democracy,
yeah. Two people prevented democracy, simply. Plus 50 other people, but whatever. First off, if he would have gotten that spending package, he would have increased the deficit, but he didn't get it because those senators blocked it, and that was a bad thing at that time. And two, the deficit decreased because we didn't have the CARES Act again and we didn't have the pandemic. And so acting like you reduced the deficit because you're some fiscally responsible budget hawk kind of guy is just a straight up lie.
By the way, the first couple of years we cut the deficit. Now, let me speak to the question of fundamental fairness for all Americans. I've been delivering real results in fiscally responsible ways. We've already cut the federal deficit over $1 trillion. I signed the bipartisan deal. Cut another $1 trillion in the next decade. It's my goal to cut the federal deficit another $3 trillion by making big corporations and very wealthy finally beginning to pay their fair share.
Now, when he says cut the deficit by $3 trillion, just so you know, he's giving you all 10-year numbers. So he's talking about cutting it by $300 billion. And when we're running $1.5 trillion deficit or something like that.
Yeah.
And so that's just to clarify. that part. And he's finally going to make people pay their fair share. That's how we're
Mike Johnson do it. Rolled his eyes for that very purpose. We talked about the fact that he claims to have cut the deficit.
Yeah. Which, by the way, it looks again like Mike Johnson is a real person. So more confirmation on that.
I'm a capitalist. If you want to make or can make a million or millions of bucks, that's great. Just pay your fair share in taxes. A fair tax code.
Like your son does.
It's how we invest things to make this country great. Healthcare, education, defense, and so much more. But here's the deal. The last administration enacted a $2 trillion tax cut. Overwhelmingly benefit the top 1%.
Because
the very wealthy,
taxes.
The biggest corporation. And exploded the federal deficit. They added more to the national debt than any presidential term in American history.
One thing that annoys me with this is that, yeah, it's true they added more to the national debt. Like, that is true. Mm-hmm. And this is not an excuse whatsoever. There was a pandemic that happened in 2020, which is why we ended up having the CARES Act and I think one other bill that had a bunch of money in it too. And that's where a bunch of it came from. Now, we already ran like a $1 trillion deficit the year before that anyway, and maybe the year before that too. I can't remember. And then he had the CARES Act come in. The reason I hate it when people like Biden mention this and say they added all this to the debt and to the deficit is that that implies that had Hillary Clinton been the president at that time, that they wouldn't have had the CARES Act, or that it would have been smaller, and that they wouldn't have spent as... So you're implying that if the pandemic would have happened while a Democrat was the president, that you wouldn't have done stimulus checks and that you wouldn't have bailed out the airlines or any of the other businesses that you... In all likelihood, the bill would have been bigger. It probably would have actually been bigger at that time.
And or so at least the same.
Or at least the same, yes. Yeah. That's true.
Does anybody really think the tax code is fair? Do you really think the wealthy and big corporations need another $2 trillion tax break? No! I sure don't. I'm going to keep fighting like hell to make it fair. Under my plan, nobody earning less than $400,000 a year will pay additional penny in federal taxes. Nobody, not one penny.
The lie behind that is that inflation is a tax, and everyone has seen, at least since he became president, an 18% inflation since he came into office. That is not all his fault. We've mentioned several times now the CARES Act, and that was signed by Trump, of course. That kind of started the fire. That got, you know, if you're sitting there starting a fire, and then Biden...
And back then, we were arguing with all the modern monetary theorists about we're going to see inflation. They're like, no. As long as we invest it correctly, we won't see the inflation. And then the inflation happens, and then all they just get quiet. And it's still not their fault.
Yeah. He did say, thanks Costco, he did say fight like hell. So I do think that that's inciting violence, I'm pretty sure. And probably impeach him for that.
Yeah,
not a bad idea.
Haven't yet. In fact, the child tax credit I passed during the pandemic cut taxes for millions of working families and cut child poverty in half. Score that child tax credit. No child should go hungry in this country. The way to make the tax code fair to make big corporations and the very wealthy begin to pay their fair share. Remember in 2020, 55 of the biggest companies in America made $40 billion and paid zero in federal income tax. Zero. Not anymore. Thanks to the law I wrote and we signed, big companies have to pay a minimum of 15%. But that's still less than working people pay in federal taxes. It's time to raise corporate minimum tax to at least 21%. So every big corporation finally begins to pay their fair share.
And every product and service you buy will be raised by 21%.
Yeah. The other thing, like what you have to keep in mind when you're watching a speech like this, you really have to think that the government can just do things and that it's not going to affect you whatsoever and that they don't have to pay for it or whatever way they pay for it is not going to affect you whatsoever. Like what Charlie just said, like, yeah, prices will just go up on stuff. So you really have to believe that there is a such thing as a free lunch to actually hear an entire speech like this and think that these are good things and that they're possible and all. This is an entire speech of like fake things and lies and propaganda and things that will never happen. That's just a really long campaign speech. And it's a weird thing too. Like, I hate this speech so much. All the clapping, all this stuff, all the fanfare, all that. I mean, wasn't the State of the Union just supposed to be like the president wrote a letter to Congress? Here you go.
Here's where we're at.
When did it become like this ceremony, like the Oscars or something like that? When did this happen?
Media.
You know what the average federal tax is for those billionaires? They're making great sacrifices, 8.2%. That's far less than the vast majority of Americans pay. No billionaire should pay a lower federal tax rate than a teacher, a sanitation worker, or a nurse. I propose
that study's been
minimum
debunked
tax for
so
billionaires
hard
of 25%. Well,
and they still use it.
They do it calling it the true tax rate, and they do it using your wealth gains, like unrealized wealth gains, and how much money you end up paying them. If you take in any income, you'll pay an income tax. If you actually realize gains on your wealth, you'll have a capital gains tax at 15%. And what they do to come up with this number is they actually look at what your wealth, unrealized wealth gains are. And then they call it like this true tax rate or whatever. And to actually do what he's about to say, which is a 25% minimum tax on billionaires, it has to be a wealth tax. If you're using the calculation he just used, because the calculation he just used looks at unrealized capital gains. And so if you're talking about a 25% minimum tax from the 8%, then you'd have to be doing a wealth tax, which would completely destroy the entire world's economy if we did this. But whatever, it's fun to say, I guess.
5%, just 25%. You know what that would raise? That would raise $500 billion over the next 10 years. And imagine what that could do for America.
Imagine what that could do for Ukraine.
That's not even as much money as we want to give the Ukraine now.
I know.
We want to give $60 billion Ukraine right now. He just said $50 billion a year. That's 3 days. That's 3 days worth of expenses for the government. And he's about to list off all this socialist freaking, this wish list that he's about to list off that we're going to do with $50 billion extra a year after you start doing wealth taxes and the economy crashes and the stock market crashes and everyone loses their retirements and all these things happen.
Nate, what's 25% of zero?
I think it might be zero, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
In the future, with affordable child care, millions of families can get they need to go to work to help grow the economy. Imagine a future with paid leave, because no one should have to choose between working and taking care of their sick family member. Imagine a future of home care and elder care and people living with disabilities so they can stay in their homes and family caregivers can finally get the pay they deserve.
Well, that's an important one to him. Yeah, so you're going to get...
Imagine there's no people.
Yeah. There you go. Problem solved. Okay. So I think we talked about that plenty during the video itself. Those are all terrible ideas. A 25% minimum billionaires tax would have to come from a wealth tax. To actually tax those people that amount of money, which is on unrealized gains, they would have to sell their ownership in these companies. You'd have to have enough people to buy all that while all the other people are having to sell too. You know, all of those billionaires, people that come in and buy it, the prices would be crazily depressed when they actually get bought out. It would chase itself down to the
bottom.
Well,
Nancy Pelosi might buy him.
Yeah, that's true.
She'll buy him when they get down there.
She will. Okay, that's only number two. All right, number three. This is a post from Good Morning Liberty. How about that? GML with Nate and Charlie. There was another part in this speech. Is that this video? Yeah. Okay.
Marijuana expunging thousands of convictions.
Nope. All right. They're talking about marijuana. Okay.
And Mary Jane.
Pardoning people, stuff like that. And there's just a part here that bothered me here for number three, which is how excited Kamala Harris was when he said this and all the applaud. And what you have to keep in mind is that Kamala Harris, while she was prosecutor, oversaw over 1,900 marijuana-related convictions while she was in California. And Joe Biden was a dude who wrote the 1994 crime bill, you know, three strike rule.
Responsible for millions of millions of minorities in prison.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
And so now they're going to talk
about...
And
then his own son does crack.
Now they're going to talk about reclassifying marijuana, which we agree with. I completely agree. And I posted this on Twitter. And well, let me play the video. It's only 15 seconds, and we'll talk about it.
See my cabinet to review the federal classification of marijuana, expunging thousands of convictions for the mere possession, because no one should be jailed for simply using or
look at her
simply
pop up.
Using. Or
she pops up. She's super excited about it. It's a good thing what he's talking about, reclassifying marijuana for sure.
Expunging the records of people who have possession of a plant.
On this post that I made, people said, well, yeah, we should make fun of people when they realize that they were wrong and change their ways on something. And I'm like, no, it's a good thing when you change your ideas on something. It is. When you figure out that you were wrong on it and you come out and you go in the other direction. My response to someone was, did they apologize? Did Joe Biden say, hey, I'm sorry? That whole crime bill thing, three strike and all that. You know, I'm sorry about the millions of people whose lives were ruined because of this. Did Kamala Harris say, like, I'm really sorry for everyone? No, she laughed about how she used to smoke weed. Did anyone apologize, or is this what happened?
And then they act like they're the
there you go.
They act like they're the heroes.
Exactly. This is what happens. They come out, they sweep it under the rug, they expect that no one is going to pay attention to
what every abuser does.
And then they are the saviors of these people that they helped put in prison in the first place.
Yeah.
That is why it's a problem. If they come out and said, hey, I'm sorry, and I'm sorry to every single person that I helped put in prison that shouldn't have been in prison, and that was wrong of me to do that, I would have a lot of respect for them for doing that, but they will never do it because they want to win re-election.
It's like the abusers who beat their wife, and then she's doing really poorly, so he takes her to the hospital.
Yeah.
Wait, what? I'm the one who took you to the hospital.
Yeah.
But you're going to leave me? But I'm the one who cared for you? I paid for those hospital bills.
I'm the one who got you those crutches. All right, that's the first half of Dumb Leap of the Week. Not really the first half, because that was only the first three. Remember, you can vote on these every week when you want to by joining the Fed Haters Club. Join GML.com. We just got through the first three, so now we got to make it through seven in the next half hour. We'll be right back on Liberty at Night with Nate Charlie on Free Talk Live Network. This is Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network. We're right in the middle of Dumb Leap of the Week. Okay, moving on to number four. This is weird. Senator Katie Britt of Alabama gave the Republican Party's response to the State of the Union. Did you see this?
I did not see this.
Okay, here's the problem. She seems like a nice enough lady. I don't know her personally, but she looks like we would get along. That's totally fine. They told her to go out there and be super serious about this and be super charismatic. I don't know, just real impactful with her speech. And here's the problem. She's a really bad actress. Okay, she's not going to get any Oscars for this performance. It actually just ends up coming off really creepy.
I never could have imagined what my story would entail. To think about what the American dream can do across just one generation, in just one lifetime.
This is the actual Republican response.
But right now, the American dream has turned into a nightmare for so many families.
How could she switch personalities like that so fast?
The true unvarnished state of
our
union.
Scary.
This is the scariest thing I've seen so far.
With this, our families are hurting. Our country can do better. And you don't have to look any further than the crisis at our southern border to see it. President Biden inherited the most secure border of all time.
Is this Gone Girl?
But minutes after
I'm telling my kids
office,
this is Gone Girl.
He suspended all deportations. He halted construction of the border.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Is the response I have.
I'm telling my kids this is Gone Girl.
Yeah, that is scary.
I think she just went into four different personalities. Mm-hmm. And within 60 seconds.
Honestly, I think Kamala Harris does a better job doing this. I would have been less scared if it were Hillary Clinton giving the speech.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth. This is not, that when you're just obviously acting like that, like this is so over-dramatized that it just comes off as fake. And so then the problem is when you're giving the GOP response to President Biden's terrible State of the Union address with all the stupid things that he just talked about, and you put up this person who's trying to make this super dramatic and impactful for everyone watching, but she sucks at it, really terrible, and she just comes off as fake and someone who can't act, well, then it kind of discredits the entire thing. So that's all I had to say about that.
Also, do you think her kitchen is that clean?
What?
Do you think her kitchen is that clean?
Well, it is in that specific spot. Or she's got a green screen behind her. I don't know. One of those things. Which one do you think it is?
I don't know. All right, number seven. This is coming from Jess Piper.
She's got two entries about school choice in here. So we're moving away from Biden, the State of the Union, propaganda, to a couple dumb things. And unlike normal dumb bleeps where I really try to stack on the dumb and the dumb and the dumb until we get up to number 10, because of today's technical difficulties.
Because of the error of your ways?
Yeah, we've probably already passed the best ones. Okay. It's all downhill from here, except for this one, which is really dumb.
All right, Jess Piper, she tweets, in Missouri, a family of four making $40,000 doesn't qualify for free school lunch, about $1,200 in benefits. In Missouri, the new school choice scheme will allow a family of four making $220,000 to qualify for school vouchers, about $14,000 in benefits. That's convenient.
So,
what an analogy.
Yeah.
That makes absolutely no sense, Jess.
It's
not the same thing.
No, those are not the same thing at all. What is a school? A school voucher is basically a representation
of a tax credit.
Yeah. You paid taxes into this system, and your tax dollars are either going to go to this school and the district in which you live, or if you would like to go to a different school, you can instead take that money and take it to a different school. It is not some type of a welfare program for you. It's supposed to be, now maybe for some people who don't actually pay any taxes into the system, you still get school vouchers. But when you're using a family that gets $220,000 a year, well, they paid in all that money and more, you know? And so What are you actually upset about here? You're just saying that instead of their money going to this school, they're going to take it and they're going to take it to this school instead. Mm-hmm. It's not the same thing.
No, it's not.
At all.
It's a horrible analogy.
Very, very terrible analogy. Loomer report. Laura Loomer, a Trump political operative, puts out this super, super racist post, like crazy racist post. And you can make a claim that Democrats are going after Donald Trump and trying to stop him from winning re-election if you want to. You could say that the justice system is being weaponized. But you shouldn't take it a step further and say, is it me or is there a certain demographic going after President Trump? And if you're not watching the video, what she puts is four pictures, and all of the pictures happen to be of black people. All of them are black. And so the point that she's trying to make in this post is that a certain demographic, black people, I guess, are going after President Trump. Now, you could make this argument if you didn't also have pictures of all of the other people who were going after Donald Trump and that they weren't all black. Like, you could look at other pictures of, well, Joe Biden could be one of them. You could say the Secretary of State in Colorado, the Maine Secretary of State. You could say Jack Smith, federal prosecutor, if you wanted to. You could say the judge in the E. Jean Carroll case, or E. Jean Carroll herself, if you wanted to. You could give all kinds of different examples of different people that are going after Donald Trump. Or you could just take screenshots of the black people and put them in a post and try to say, what are you trying to say? What's she trying to say?
She's trying to get more followers.
Okay. There
you go. It's about being controversial.
See, I was actually trying to ascribe some kind of a meaning behind what she was trying to say. And I think you hit the nail on the head.
It's about being controversial, as you possibly can to get as many followers as you possibly can.
She's trying to get followers.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
This is what she wants. She wants people talking about it.
If I were Trump or any other, which by the way, there were
tons. This to me is like selling your soul, you know, for the fame.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're giving up on any principles you could possibly have. And it's like, well, if I get more followers, I'll be a little racist. It's fine.
Yeah, sure. Whatever.
It's, man.
I back off sometimes.
Which is why we might be the most, you know, forever mediocre podcast there ever will be.
All right. Speaking of things that are racist, I guess I didn't mean to tie these two together, but here's number nine, AG Merrick Garland, talking about voting rights. And of course, once again, Republicans are trying to stop black people from voting because I guess Republicans know that there's no way that black people can afford to get IDs, yeah, or they can figure out how to go to a ballot box or anything like that.
Uh-huh.
And Democrats are, that's why they're trying to pass laws like this, is to keep black people from voting.
Yep.
And so, of course, Democrats also know this fact of life, according to them, and they're trying to protect
the minorities.
Guys, just imagine going in front of a room full of black people and actually talking about these things like you believe that they were true. Like, that's what you're saying. I know that there's just no way y'all can afford to get driver's licenses. Oh, I know that you
can't afford groceries.
I know that you can't figure out, you know, if we don't do mail-in ballots, if we don't actually have a physical person walk a mail-in ballot to your house and have you sign off on it and then take it from you, there's just no way you can go to a polling booth. I get it. It's just not possible.
You don't have access to the internet. You can't look these things up.
Okay, here's some.
The right to vote is still under attack. And that is why the Justice Department is fighting back. That is why one of the first things I did when I came into office was to double the size of the voting section of the Civil Rights Division. That is why we are challenging efforts by states and jurisdictions to implement discriminatory, burdensome, and unnecessary restrictions on access to the ballot, including those related to mail-in voting, the use of drop boxes, and voter ID requirements. That is why we are working to block the adoption of discriminatory redistricting plans that dilute the vote of black voters and other voters of color.
I try to give him the benefit of the doubt a little bit and just say, like, maybe he does really think that black people can't figure out how to vote. I don't know why I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt on that.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to. I also would like to give Republicans a little bit of benefit of the doubt, which is also terrible. Like, what if you actually think that things like mail-in voting and drop boxes and not requiring voter ID actually makes an election less secure and opens it up for more fraud, which is actually dangerous to democracy when possibly there could be fraud, or in fact, even the threat of fraud can make people not have any trust in our institutions. And that maybe they want to fix that. And if you have voter ID requirements and you had specific polling places and you didn't have widespread mail-in balloting, that actually when there was a result in an election, all of the country would be like, okay, yeah, that was their result in the election. I didn't like that, but there you go.
Yeah.
Maybe that would be better for a democracy itself. I don't know.
That's too logical, Nate.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought maybe it was. Okay, number 10, let's get this one out of the way. I'm sorry, maybe some people aren't going to agree with this. Angela McArdle, she's not the dumb subject of this. But I am sorry, I'm going to talk about this idea once again, because once again, people are mentioning that maybe RFK Jr. going to go up to that Libertarian convention and can convince the delegates to vote, and that he can be the Libertarian Party nominee, and he gets ballot access across, I think, almost all the states. I think maybe there's one or two states they don't have access at yet. And the Libertarian Party is going to get more money. They're going to secure ballot access in the future for some time, and that's going to be a good thing for everyone. Win-win situation. I happen to think it's a terrible idea. We can watch some of the video if you want to do that first.
Yeah. You know, we have a very ornery group of delegates. They're very interested in finding the best, most principled messenger, someone who represents us ideologically. And we also have a group of people who are very focused on ballot access. And of course, having Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as our candidate would absolutely seal ballot access for us. But it's not decided yet.
Right.
I think that if he became our nominee, there would be an understanding with us that he doesn't 100% represent us ideologically. He is getting ballot access by using our name and branding. And in return, we are securing ballot access for the future. For better or worse, we would also be potentially unlocking some federal funding. If that happens, it's going to have to be a conscious decision of the delegates and a mutually beneficial relationship.
My question, because I understand all of the points, I get it. It would be great for the Libertarian Party itself to have a, it would be the biggest Libertarian Party vote that there had ever been. Sadly enough, not for a Libertarian, but it would be the biggest one. They would raise the most amount of money for the party. Maybe that helps people on the down ballot side, you know, other smaller races. It would be good for them to use that as a way to raise money. I get all the arguments. I understand them for sure. So why not Nikki Haley? That's why, if the idea is you're just going to run someone because it's going to help you with ballot access around the country and you're going to raise a bunch of money and unlock federal funding, why not Nikki Haley?
Why not Gary Johnson and Bill Weld?
I know what RFK has got a few good ideas and he was against, you know, people say he was good on COVID. He wasn't good on COVID lockdowns. He is good on the vaccine side of the COVID problem. I mean, seriously, if I put him up to Nikki Haley, I know people are thinking war. RFK is as big or bigger on Israel as Nikki Haley is. So you're not going to get out of that one. The difference probably would be with the Ukraine funding. But at that point, you're talking about a difference of a couple hundred billion dollars, something like that. I trust Nikki Haley more on the environment. I trust her more on taxes and penalties on businesses. I trust her more on guns. I'm not trying to make an argument for Nikki Haley right now. What I'm trying to say is,
Nate's voting for Nikki.
What I'm trying to say is, where do you draw the line? What makes him more libertarian than any other number of people who would draw even more votes than he would? She even wants to do entitlement reforms. Like, y'all keep talking about this. She even wants to do that.
Is Trump a conservative Republican?
No. Trump is a 1995 Democrat.
If Vivek were to run on the Libertarian Party, is that someone who's principled enough? Mm-hmm. Where's the line? How do, like, because I'm both sides on this. I get both sides. I really do. This is a really tough one. Because it's not like, do you agree with everything Dr. Ron Paul has said or done?
I doubt that I agree with everything he has said or done, but I would have to do some research before I could tell you the things.
Instead of running in the GOP, though, if he ran, you know, in the Libertarian Party, mm-hmm. would that be, is so he principled enough?
To me, it comes down to, you know, I didn't vote for Gary Johnson for a specific reason, and it was the bake the cake argument. And it wasn't because I cared about the cake bacon or anything like that. It's because I cared about whether or not you believe that human beings own themselves. And what he said was that the state should be able to compel you to provide a service for another person. And so at that point, he crossed the line for me. I don't care about all the other stuff. There's like a fundamental philosophical idea that a libertarian right there has to have. Like, do human beings own themselves, or does the government get to control what people do? And maybe you want to do that at the least amount possible or whatever. But at the end of the day, who owns the person? Is it the government or is it the person? And Gary Johnson crossed that line with the cake bacon thing. RFK easily crosses that line for me. Easily. So does Nikki Haley, by the way. I'm asking where you draw the line on that. If it's about getting votes and money into the party, you know, why stop there?
No.
That's
run Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, go ahead. Run Bernie Sanders. None of them would be libertarians at all. So let's go for the most amount of money possible for the party. I don't know. What
I think libertarians are a lot like women. Tough to define.
Yeah.
You know, could make a whole documentary on what is a libertarian.
Mm-hmm.
No one knows. Just like what is a woman.
So
once a libertarian is someone who says they're a libertarian. Just like a woman.
Just to be clear, I don't think even if RFK goes to the convention and makes his case, I don't think he has any chance of winning the Libertarian Party nomination. Especially, this is what I think, after the Mises takeover and all of that. Like, to me, this just kind of kills the whole... What is the point of the party after this? If you're just going to... Every year, you will be confronted with the fact that if you run someone who's not a libertarian, you'll do better. Every year, that will be the case. What if Dave Smith doesn't run every year? We should just run someone who's not a libertarian that's going to get more votes? Is that why we had the Mises Party take over, Mises Caucus take over the party? Because, well, it was crazy to have Bill Weld on there. He's going to bring all this money into the party. And Gary Johnson.
Then he endorsed Hillary Clinton.
We got to take it over afterwards. To what? Do the same thing?
This is tough. I got to say, it's tough. There's an argument to play the long game here. Libertarian Party hasn't been relevant since its inception. What is the GOP and the Democratic Party, what are they doing differently to gain the popularity that they have over the last, whatever, 100 years?
populism.
And then how do you compete in that? Like, if I think about it in sports terms, you know, like, how do I get LeBron James on my team? No, obviously he's not the greatest basketball player of all time, but he's still one of the best in the league. Right. Yeah. And if you had a choice between like him and, you know, somebody you've never heard of, wouldn't you want that guy on your team to win the most amount of games?
My question is, what's the point? The lesser of three evils is still evil. So what's the point?
Well, how else are we going to get someone in there?
In what?
Well, here's
another Republican Party.
But we're still,
who cares?
But we're still arguing about Band-Aids, right?
Yeah.
The real issue is it shouldn't matter who's president. Like it, but the problem is we have all this power. Okay. So how do we start to restrain this power? Like, don't you have to rise to the occasion to then bring it down without being corrupted?
I don't think we need to do it by nominating people who want that power. Like, RFK solutions are that we need to put nice guys in office or nice guys in the bureaucracy. The freaking bureaucracy that murdered half his family is like, oh, yeah, they just need better people to run those things. That's the problem. Well, what happens when the next guy gets in there?
I'm not saying he's the guy, but I'm saying, is there a guy? You know? What if Trump decided to run as a libertarian? Would you vote for Trump?
No.
Is he not the most libertarian president in your lifetime?
I didn't vote for Trump last time, so why would I vote for him if he magically had a libertarian party next to his name?
Ronald Reagan.
No, still not. Good Lord, have you ever looked at a chart? I'm sorry, I know Ronald Reagan has done great things for our YouTube channel. All right? And he said some great stuff, and I wish we had that kind of pro-America rhetoric and that hopeful rhetoric in today's day and age. But we just don't have good enough actors that want to run for president, okay? But if you look at a chart of government growth, you can easily tell me what year Ronald Reagan came into office. You can't. I was looking at one the other day. Like, you can circle when he got into office. So, no, still not Ronald Reagan. Still not, because I don't see the point.
So who could run and actually make some noise?
Rand Paul, Justin Amash.
How do you win
Thomas
the game?
Thomas Massey, Dave Smith, you know, Spike Cohen. People that are, I mean, you would say Rand Paul and Thomas Massey and Justin Amash are way more libertarian than RFK is.
True.
They're way more philosophically consistent than RFK would be. I'm just saying, you got to pick someone who's actually on that spectrum for me to consider voting for it. Or at the end of the day, it's just, I don't care that it says Libertarian Party. Here's a candidate that sucks, a candidate that sucks, and a candidate that sucks. I don't care what names are next to their name at all. So why would I vote for them? Now, that's just me. And I get all the mechanics of it. I understand ballot access, money coming in. But the problem is, once you decide to do that, guess what? Next election cycle, you're going to be faced with the same problem.
And I'm not saying you're wrong.
You know,
I probably agree with you. I'm very much against compromising principles for any sort of other gain. Because again, what I just mentioned earlier, you're selling your soul, you know, for popularity or whatever the case may be. I'm very much against that. My question is, how does the Libertarian Party have a principled candidate that can actually slightly challenge the status quo? How?
I'm not sure that they do. That's why I'm not sure that they do. I'm sorry. As it might be my actual answer. And I would take Vivek Ramaswamy on the ticket over RFK any day. When it comes down to the bureaucracy, at least Vivek understands that these agencies have to go. Or if he can't do that, he understands that almost all of them need to be fired. At least he gets that. RFK wants to reform them and show them the right PowerPoint presentations to make them good people or something like that.
How does a Javier Milei in Argentina become, how do we get that in America?
The way Javier Milei makes it is that you get the 200% inflation and you have half the country in poverty. And at that point, people will listen to whoever's saying they're going to change things with a chainsaw. So I'm not saying it's an easy fix and I get all of the arguments for it. I totally understand. But I'd have to, if you're going to compromise some, it's got to be someone who at least can be close to philosophically consistent with libertarianism. and RFK Jr. does not believe that people own themselves. He does not. And that is a core principle that any Libertarian Party candidate that I would ever vote for.
So what you're saying is you should run for president.
No, I will never run for president. We got to vote. Let's see. Number one, Biden's housing comments. Number two, Biden's comments on the minimum taxes for corporations and for billionaires. Number three, the response to him saying that no one should be put in jail for weed. Number four was Katie Britt's GOP response to the State of the Union. Number five is the Cookie Monster. Number six, Joe Scarborough and the North Korea level propaganda. Number seven, Jess Piper on school choice. Number eight, the Loomer report or Laura Loomer racist demographic going after Trump thing. Number nine, Garland voter ID. And number 10, this idea that RFK should run under the Libertarian Party. And if you guys haven't noticed today, I'm wearing a couple merch items right now. I got a hat on right now. It says taxation is theft. I got a shirt on that says power corrupts. And you can find both of these fine items at godhatesfeds.com. So we got a Javier Milei shirts. We got a Ron Paul shirt. Got some hats, got some mugs. And of course, the God Hates Feds shirt itself, the OG shirt.
Looks like minimum taxes.
Yeah.
Spread out, though. The vote's pretty spread.
Everyone's, we have a bunch of different people that have different, I mean, like everything's got a vote. But the minimum tax idea, corporate tax, billionaire tax. He also talked about how he reduced the deficit by $1 trillion, stuff like that. And that is the winner. All right, y'all, that does it for this Tuesday night. We'll see you again next week on Liberty at Night with Nate and Charlie on the Free Talk Live Network.
This is Mark Edge with Free Talk Live. Mark Warden with PorcupineRealEstate.com is one of the best real estate agents I've ever worked with. I've been through about 24 real estate transactions in my life, and I feel like I know what I'm doing, but there's always the things that you don't know that you don't know. Mark Warden with PorcupineRealEstate.com found a problem with the house that I was buying that ultimately saved me $65,000. He's a consummate professional, holds his people to his own high standards, and I would unequivocally recommend him for any real estate purchase in New Hampshire. Don't sell yourself short. Contact PorcupineRealEstate.com.